Hello, you're listening to Otaku Spirit Anime Cast. My name's Andrew. I'm joined here with Chris.
Yo.
Today's episode is our first parter of our spring 2022 anime season reviews. We have a ton of titles to go through. Next week, we'll have a ton more. I almost wanted to do three-week layout, but I always hate that because by the time you get to the third week, it's like you have to start reminding yourself like what you thought of the show because it's already leaving you because the new season's kicking up. But yeah, this week we have Vampire in the Garden, Ascendance of Bookworm Season 3, Your Boy Kong Ming, or Komei, A Heron-san is Indecipherable, or A Heron-san wa Hakaranai, The Executioner and Her Way of Life, Science Fell in Love, So I Try to Prove It Season 2, Dance 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 Duo, Trapped in a Dating Sim, The World of Otome Games is Tough for Mobs, Healer Girl, I'm Quitting Heroing, Tomodachi Game, The Greatest Demon Lord is Reborn as a Typical Nobody, Day I'm On, and RPG Real Estate. It's a lot. It's a lot. But that's good. That's good for people that listen because they're like, oh, okay, tons of content. Don't matter that Andrew suffers. It don't matter that Andrew suffers. We get tons of content. The appreciation is appreciated, as they say. So I don't know what they say that. I said that. But anywho, as usual, we're from otakuspirit.com. You can go there for all of our links to our social media, Discord, Twitter, all that kind of stuff, as well as ways that you can support us through Patreon, through Tips Link, all that kind of stuff. We definitely appreciate everybody that supports us. And if you're listening on YouTube, you can hit that Super Thanks button to show your appreciation. But yeah. With that said, let's jump right into it because it's going to be a long recording probably. But let's start things off with Vampire in the Garden. This one was streaming on Netflix, ran for 5 episodes, done by Wit Studio. It is an original. The genres are action, drama, fantasy. And this one follows, it takes place in a world where vampires suddenly showed up. And since there was tons of humans, tons of food, the vampires quickly spread throughout the world. At some point, humankind kind of found one last bastion of hope. They secluded themselves behind this wall of light, basically, this big, you know, fortress that has tons of light so that the vampires can't come in. And we follow Momo, who is a child that lives in this fortress. And it kind of gives us indication that everybody's kind of trying to live as much as possible within this location. So everybody's got a number, and she's a number. But as we'll quickly find out, her mother is actually the leader of the general of the army itself. And so there's a lot of expectations upon her, but she just kind of wants to enjoy her time. But she just joined the army eventually and starts going out on missions to clear out vampires in the surrounding areas. At some point, she runs into a child vampire and kind of hesitates for a moment. That child has this little music box with her and it kind of throws her off. But then the vampire decides to inject this serum thing they use that makes them like awaken their true power, which is like very difficult for them to handle. But she survives, but she takes this music box back home, hides it because apparently mankind has decided to completely ban music because vampires have very heightened senses, so they can hear music even though they're behind the walls with lots of noise. Anyways, that aside, on the other side of the whole thing, we follow Fine. And Fine is seemingly a princess of the vampires themselves. Doesn't seem to care too much about it. Finds the war against the humans to be, you know, just wasteful. What's the point in taking over the lands from the humans when it's just being covered with blood? So kind of a neutralist and wants to keep things neutral, wants to get rid of war, that kind of stuff. So doesn't want to get herself involved at all. Well, just so happens, wouldn't you know it, these two meet. As the vampires attack the humans, Fine, off on her own, ends up running into Momo, who's, you know, just trying to get away from all the battling and stuff like that. And Fine decides to swoop up Momo because she was singing a song that kind of reminded her of somebody from the past. And so it kind of follows the two of them. Yeah, Momo's not too happy about being taken away by some vampire, but at the same time, the two of them find some common ground in music. And in this kind of common ground, the two of them seek to find the one place where both humans and vampires can live peacefully, kind of thing. So, yeah, star-crossed lovers, insert that.
Oh, I was wondering if we were going for...
It's not really... It definitely has that aspect because, obviously, the two sides are warring. The vampires don't like the idea that their princess is running off with some human, obviously. The other side, the general is not too happy about her daughter being whisked away, and that looks bad upon her. So, you know, it's the relationship and the friendship that's not allowed, but at the same time, the two of them wanting to get away from everything and just live happy. But, yeah, it's not, it kind of feels very star-crossed lovers at first, but that it kind of doesn't really rely on it too much. I think, first of all, the thing that I love most about this five episodes kind of feels like a movie. It has a very, you know, a fluid storyline that it kind of goes through. I think the pacing is perfect in this series. It never feels like it's, you know, hanging on a note. It just kind of keeps moving. It doesn't move too fast. So pacing, perfect. I don't like the style. Like, I don't like the art style at all. I think Wit Studio did a fantastic job of kind of utilizing that style, but it's not my favorite style ever. Characters have very kind of oval heads, very plain looking, but visually outside of that, very beautiful. Minus the CGI cars and those ones. There was one particular scene where this car just, like, they're in this car and it takes off, and it just looks like it's just jumping around on the mountains off in the distance. It's like, that looked terrible. Don't ever do that again. Yeah, CGI cars, they don't look that great, but everything outside of that, visually, artistically, looks very beautiful. They do a really good job with tones, colors, and all that kind of stuff to really make the show, despite the fact that I have my misgivings of the art style, just really pop. But yeah, other than that, like I said this earlier, the pacing's perfect, and I think the story's really solid. And I think that really comes in the two focal characters, Momo and Fine, and I think they did a really good job of their character. Like, I believe that with Momo, she's kind of a character that at first seems like she's just kind of slouching around and whining, kind of. Like, she's very childlike. But by the end of the show, you really do see this confidence come inside of her that really does change her character a lot. And that's kind of odd because on the opposite end, Fine's character, it changes as well. And you could argue that it's her, you know, losing character. Any idea that she gets weaker, like she has a lot of confidence at the very beginning, whereas towards the later part, she doesn't have confidence. And that's really in the instincts of the vampire itself, because I think this writer is one of those types that doesn't kind of shy away from reality. Like, the writer does allow the characters to have to exist and live and struggle in the realities of the world they're in, which is, yes, vampires, and they want blood. So you do have, you know, the idea of the fears that Fine has around Momo, who she starts to care for a lot, and now she's obviously has these desires, because Fine is one of those vampires that never drinks blood kind of things, and how that affects them. But like I said earlier, I really like how they managed to bring in the realities of the world itself and not really sugarcoat it, really kind of examine it and allow the characters to fail and do horrible things, but at the same time, learn, reflect, and change based on it. And I think that's where it's not just mean for the sake of being mean, but mean for character growth and mean for characters to learn something from it. On the opposite end, I really do like the fact that a lot of the characters, the side characters around Momo and Fine, there's not much to them. They do give a little bit of context to one of the side characters who's currently chasing after Momo under the orders of Dobara. They do kind of get a little bit into him, and it's really kind of a reflection of what was and what is now. This idea that because I failed here, will you fail too? This won't happen because it couldn't happen for me. And how somebody could stand up and change that going forward. So they're very simple stories on the sidelines, but they're still solid to driving the main storyline, which I thought was good. Which, again, is the idea of two warring sides trying to find something in between, having peace and being alone, but having the world itself bearing down on you. And like I said, not sugarcoating that, not giving some fantastic... Not everything has to be peachy in the end, obviously. Nothing really changes just because one girl stands up and changes the world kind of thing. It's the immovable object, so to speak. So, like I said before, it's not groundbreaking story here, but it was a really solid five episodes to tell a really solid story that I thoroughly enjoyed. Wit Studio being there, a lot of the action scenes, a lot of the drama that happens throughout the series looks absolutely fantastic. A lot of the scenes where they do have, you know, people fighting over fighting over Momo and Fine and all that kind of stuff around that was spectacular. So I really did enjoy it. I had a lot of fun watching it. Like I said before, it's not sugarcoated. Great pacing. I would say perfect pacing. It was never a lulling point throughout this series. So definitely a suggestion from me if you're looking for a solid vampire show. At the same time, don't expect like some groundbreaking overall story. It's a really solid story about two people just trying to find you know, somewhere where they can be alone, away from the wars kind of thing. So, yeah, yeah. That's Vampire in the Garden. Check it out if that sounds interesting to you. Fortunately, on Netflix. Enjoy that $20 admission fee. or other methods. There's other methods too, I guess. Moving on, we have Ascendance of a Bookworm, Season 3, Honzuki no Kekikocho Shisho ni Naru Tame ni wa Shudan wo Eren, I hate this word every time I have to say it, Eren de Ira Re Masen, sorry, third season. I'm just going to say the English title from now on. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 10 episodes, done by Studio Ajay Do. The source is a light novel. The genres are fantasy and slice of life. I guess to start things off, slight spoilers. I don't think we'll get into anything super spoilery, but I just want to put that in there. I highly recommend people just going to check out the series completely blind. Just jump right in there, start watching it, because it's always been a high suggestion from us ever since the first season aired. But just wanted to get that slight warning in there just for people that don't want any spoilers, because we have to talk about season 3. So it's been, we're way into the story at this point. But yeah, this one, for those that are unaware, follows Mine. She was a huge bookworm in our modern times, gets transported into another world, into the body of a girl named Mine. I said Mine twice, huh? A girl who's a bookworm gets transported into the body of a girl named Mine. And she's in this other world. She's in a family of commoners, and then there's nobles in this world that have all the power, plus also magical power. And at some point, we find out that Mine's new body that she's in, or at least the body of Mine, that's a very confusing to say for some reason right now. She's a very frail body. She gets really sick really easily, can't really go out on her own. Of course, she really badly wants a book, so she decides to, because she's a commoner, doesn't have money to buy books. Books are only for really nobles and very rich people. She decides that she's going to make books. So she's using technology and knowledge of our current times to make her own book. And eventually, because of her illness, which they come to find out is called devouring, which is this kind of an over amounts of mana. Because they find out about that, she gets the interest of the church, where she's able to work there, get rid of the mana, and thus sustain her life. At the same time, her work's trying to create her own printing press and everything like that starts to get the attention of the guilds and stuff that run different parts of merchant work that happens. So she's catching the attention of a lot of people, obviously, and this affects her life a lot. And so it kind of turns into a game of not really cat and mouse, but just her kind of trying to keep the people around her, trying to keep her status a secret, while at the same time trying to keep her in places that can keep her safe from people that want to either abuse her or use her knowledge against her will. Obviously, different powers, nobles and stuff that want her power itself, while, you know, like I said, the merchant guilds and stuff wanting to take her and use her knowledge for their own benefit. So, yeah, eventually she gets into the church, and that was pretty much most of the second season was her in the church. And I think in the third season, the more the focus kind of shifts to pretty much the merchants wanting to find her, and then, yes, certain people of the church itself trying to exploit her as well. So I realized I was recording my third season review, and I at some point realized it sucks to say this, but I think one of the things I'm growing more and more in love with this series is, and this, like I said, it's really sad to say this, is that Mine is like internally suffering. Like, she is the type that is always suffering. She's always being put through terrible stuff. This isn't ReZero, where it's like, you know, blood and gore and bloom and stuff like that. It's more just suffering through losing things and trying to establish things, but then losing it again. I'd argue that she's, in a sense, been isekai three times at this point. Just from like one safety and comfort to the next safety and comfort to the next safety and comfort, always establishing the new norms for herself, but then getting ripped out of it again against her will. And I think that despite that, the positive nature of Mine has always been kind of this shining beacon, in that no matter, yes, it's because she always finds a driving force, she always has this goal in mind, but at the same time, she always has this positive nature that's, she seems like she's extremely selfish. She's a very selfish character, in the idea that she doesn't really care. She just wants to read a book. I want to get my book. Like, the whole thing with the orphanage was, I guess I'll go handle the situation with the orphanage because I can't enjoy my book unless I do that first. And it's like, yeah, you soon did, eh? It's like this idea of like, she's a kind-hearted person, but it always she always gives off this mask that she's a selfish person, even though she is, in a sense. But her positive nature and her willingness to help other people has always kind of pushed her forward in positivity, despite the fact that she's always had her face kind of shoved in the dirt. I'll let you talk for a little bit.
Of course, we've made no bones about it, how much we love this show. And I really do love this show. One of the things that is very fascinating about this particular season that I really did love is how much weight they put on in the background. It's funny because you have this contrast between mine kind of, in a way, she seemed very oblivious to the issue, and yet she was very aware of it. She just didn't, it didn't seem like she was really aware of how much weight there was. And yet we, as the viewers, we could see her, her naivety to a point, just kind of bumbling along, continuing forward, going, no, it's not really as bad as you're making it out to be. And you could really see how everybody else is, trying to, in some ways, accommodate her, and at the same time, try to press on her how much weight there is in this situation. And I think that the writer pulled that off very well. And when everything comes smashed in her face and she's faced with the reality of it, it's as harsh as it seems. I think that you said in your in one of your videos that this is the best case scenario for what was really there in front of her. I loved the way that the writer does that in this aspect of keeping her in her, giving her a lot of leeway, and yet still making her face the consequences of her actions. And so I really do love that all of this stuff is balanced in very fairly, in a lot of, not fairly, it just balanced well. When it comes down to it,
that was the thing I always kind of come to grips with, is like, I always feel like I love Ferdinand. Ferdinand's a great character. Like, Ferdinand's one of the best characters in anime right now. And and what's great is, as much as I love Ferdinand, I love the two of them together. Mine and Ferdinand have like a great chemistry, and that's mainly because Ferdinand pretty much knows who Mine is. And there's like this difficulty that you always kind of face where Ferdinand's always helping her be comfortable. He's always accommodating her with things. But at the same time, he's always instilling upon her this reality. And the reality is always very tough to really swallow. And I mean, we have a situation with that, again, towards the later part of the third season, where this realization of, hey, Mine, guess what? Things could be a lot worse. Like, despite the fact that we're like, crap, it feels like she's being ripped from things and ripped from things and ripped from things, taken away from, you know, established relationship with people, it always has this, like, reminder of, yeah, but they can all die, too. Like, there is another option. But we're choosing this direction because we kind of don't want you to go crazy. That's the combination, is what it's for. So in the case of, like, Ferdinand, it's always like, does he really care about Mine? It always has that feeling of, like, do you really care about Mine? Obviously, it feels like he does. Let's just be truthful. But there's always this idea of, like, is he being kind because he wants to keep her in check, her emotions in check? Or, but it's also the opposite effect of, yes, technically, he's the first one to say, if you're a threat, I will be the first to draw my sword. If you are captured by another domain, I will be the first one to end you. Like, he's willing to say, as much as you see the two of them and they look so great together, you are technically still a threat. And that's, like, again, one of those bottled up things of, like, I love this writer so much because this writer knows how to create side characters that aren't just puppets to Mine. They're not there just to serve Mine's goals. They're not there just to, you know, push her narrative forward. They're not there to serve a purpose for the next part of her plot line. They're always there as their own character with their own desires and their own goals. Ferdinand even says it at some point, like, now I'll finally be able to take care of this issue I've always had. Like, he himself has his own purposes. It's typically, as we've seen so far, I mean, it could change, it could be lying, to the betterment of the domain. the domain that they are in, they call it the city or kingdom that they're in, and they call it their domain. And whatever benefits that domain is what his focus is. It's not to something else. Whereas other people, and again, he could be lying, whereas other people seem to have their own desires for their own domains and whatnot. So, or they don't have a desire for the current domain. It's really great. It's really refreshing. I always argue, and we say it every single time, don't go in this because, or don't avoid this show because it's an isekai, because it's unlike any isekai you've ever watched. Yes, she's transported to another world. That's pretty much it. And she's using knowledge from the previous world to, you know, create technologies, but that's pretty much it. Like, there's really no other, there's no her getting a harem, which you can argue Ferdinand and all these other guys around her, Lutz, Gil, but no, it's not her getting a harem. It's not, you know, she's technically has an overpoweredness, but...
Yeah, it comes to the cost.
But it's killing her. Like, we always argue every time we talk about the show, ever since the first season, we had this mindset that there's a possibility, and they maybe didn't adapt it into the anime, or maybe it's never answered in the light novel. There's an argument to be made that mine, the self that she was placed inside of, died that day, and that this girl transported to this world inserted into her body after that, because she's like, she's deathly ill from the very beginning. And it's like, yeah, great, you have mana, but the mana is kind of poison. And yes, it can be used to be powerful. She doesn't know how to use it, and plus, it's dangerous, and plus, the whole reason she's being put through hell constantly is because of that mana. Like, it's the idea of the character that doesn't want the attention because they know that it's just going to draw unwanted attention. It's kind of like that, but it's the idea that, yeah, everybody, if they know that she has that power, is going to come after her. And they will take her and abuse her and use her for their own gains and never have a single ounce of care for her well-being, which they could essentially kill her with that mana. So it's not a good thing. Like, her only benefit in this world is that she has knowledge of technologies, and there's limits to that. Like, she even runs into things that she doesn't know about, and so she's trying to figure it out. Or the rules are different in this world, such as ingredients for certain things, like inks and colors is different in this world. So it's not as she can just say, well, just use this for this ink color. Well, we don't have that. We use this right here. But anyways, it's fantastic show. It has always been a fantastic show. It's pretty much so much that whenever I finish Mushoku Tensei, I might go straight into A Sentence of Bookworm after that. But that's 5 years from now because of the rate that Andrew reads, takes down notes, records videos for Mushoku Tensei. It might take a while. But yeah, I would love to dive right into this night novel because I'm already hearing, obviously, that stuff is cut for anime purposes. But it's kind of one of those stories where Every adaptation, you know, they cut stuff. There's a lot of inner dialogue and stuff that just doesn't meet pacing, and there's content that they don't think is necessarily needed for the adaptation. But it is one of those ones where I just want to know any extra detail, like anything. If she sneezed in episode 13 and we missed it because they didn't adapt it, I want to know about it. But that's kind of my mentality.
That means somebody's talking about her.
Exactly. That's true. Maybe back there in episode 13, Bindelwald was already working on it. But, yeah, it is that type of show. And I'm glad this has gotten 3 seasons. I really do hope that we get a 4th season. There's nothing been confirmed at this point or stated besides the typical to be continued, which literally every show does that because everybody wants more adaptations. I just hope that Aja Do, obviously, this is like one of their most successful properties, if anything. And I'm hoping that it's enough that they can, you know, say, hey, guys, can we keep going? Because it's not Aja Do's choice, obviously. It's the publisher's choice if they want to keep adapting, or the production committee. If they're getting benefit from it, obviously, it seems like A Sentence of Bookworm is selling insanely well as a book series, which I'm super happy about. But I'd love a full adaptation of this. And it's one of those ones where I'm solid chapter close, but I always want more. Like, I always want more. Like, just keep going in the vein.
Yeah, when it comes down to it, it's like we're all, every time the chapter close happens, we're right there on the edge of the seat going, what happens next? It's not like a cliffhanger type ending. It's just a, what happens next?
Yeah, well, I think it's more of the fact that so much changes. Like, there's these dramatic shifts in her life, again, that she doesn't get to choose and is often forced upon her. Like I mentioned, the idea, the the isekai within isekai kind of thing. It's not that literal changing worlds, but her world is changing constantly. And I struggled when we went to the church in the second season. It was like it might have been late first season, but I know second season, of course, going into the church stuff was like, I don't know if I want to do this. I liked what we were doing over here in the commoner section and what she was trying to get a book, and now we're doing this stuff. And it's like, every single time I go, oh, this is why the writer's doing this. I really like this. Like, every time I have at this point found myself saying, I know the writer's going to do something for a reason. I know this is going to be for a good reason, even though I really hate this right now.
To give credit to the production team, just on a side note, the fact that there's 10 episodes in the season, when Andrew had first mentioned it to me, I was like, that's disappointing. I kind of really want more out of this. But when it comes down to it, I think that there was probably a solid reason for it cutting off at the point that it did, where it was, you could see that this is a definite into one portion of her life. And for those of you who watch the show, know exactly what we're talking about.
Those who know, know.
No, yeah, you know exactly what we're talking about. There's an into one part of her life and the beginning of a new part of her life. And I think that it needed to be there at that point. And anything past that point would have been probably just way too much opening. And then we would have been whining and screaming and cursing the ground that the producers had walked on because of what they would have introduced if they had gone into the next part.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like I said, internal suffering for mine is it's definitely much. It's something to be said whenever you have a character that's put through so much terrible crap, and you're like, you're bawling your eyes out. It's proof that you just absolutely love the show that you're watching. And I think mine is easily one of my favorite characters of all time. Just a fantastic character through and through. I love her character. Like I said, I love that she's selfish. I love that she cares. I love that she has all these different sides about herself. And no matter how much she's brought down, she always somehow kind of forces a smile, so to speak. But it's just good stuff. All the characters are fantastic, except for the High Priest. High Priest can die in a fire. Every character besides the High Priest and Bindewald can go to, are fantastic. I just love them to death. And you got quite a bit of Delia too. And I always struggle with Delia. I kind of struggle alongside mine with the situation with Delia. Honestly, it sucks because it equally selfish character, but one of those characters she's been trying to slowly pull out of that bad place that Delia's in, and she just keeps kind of going back. I broke my heart the moment they were saying, you know, just let Delia go. You have to let Delia go. And it's like, I kind of want to say the same thing. If I was in that room, I'd probably say the same thing, but it's like, but I know she's working on her. Like, I know she's working on her.
I don't hate Delia so much. I don't hate her. I'm frustrated with her decisions. But at the same time, I think that in a lot of ways you can understand them. And
you seen the orphanage before mine got there?
Yeah,
it was a dark room with starving kids.
Exactly, and she found herself a way to survive. And that's one of the frustrating things is you can't fault her for her bad decisions. But at the same time, yes, I don't disagree in the aspect of yes, it's frustrating to see her make those. And I think that this was probably the best case where she had to face the consequences of her actions. This is one of the things that I do love about this writer more than anything is people facing consequences for their actions. And I said that with mine. I mean that for everybody in the cast. They all, in a lot of ways, face the consequences of their actions.
Except for Otto. Otto needs to face some consequences. I've always been pro Otto. I think Otto is fantastic. I've loved Otto ever since the moment that he was doing the riding stuff at the gates with mine, and he has his kid and everything. It was super cute. And then the moment that we had something happen this season, Otto just standing there. I was like, "What the hell are you doing, Otto? Like, what is Otto doing?" Dad's seen it, went after it, but Otto is just like standing there. But yeah, that was a little bit frustrating. Otto broke my heart. Anyways, jokes aside, Fantastic season, as always. A sense of bookworm. Highly, highly recommend. I always say this all the time as well. This is one of the shows that I love that every time I suggest it and somebody comes back and says, hey, you suggested that A Sentence of Bookworm. I always have that heart drop. Like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, here. What are they going to say? Please say that you liked it. Please say that you like it. And sure enough, it's always positive. And I know that every time I say that, somebody's going to go in the comments and say it negatively just to get at me. But every time, people are just like, thanks for suggesting this show. And it's like, Everybody gets it. It's just kind of, you know it's something special there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It makes me feel pretty good to know that somebody has actually taken our advice on this one and given this one a shot and has absolutely loved it.
And thankfully to all the source material people for keeping all the spoilers in check as usual. This is another one of those ones as I'm doing videos on it episode by episode. It's like every time I look in the comment section, it's like you kind of keep wincing and looking away like, please don't be a spoiler. Please don't. I think most people like the adaptation. I mean, obviously there's a lot of stuff that's cut and there's a little bit of context shifting, but for the most part, I didn't really see anybody like, you know, this character was supposed to die here or this character was not supposed to die here kind of stuff. It's always kind of, yeah, there's a little bit more context here, which would have been nice to have in there. But I think overall, I think it's been I don't notice anything. And I think that's enough. Like I said, I can go into the light novel later and get more context. I mean, same as Mushoku Tensei. Obviously I'm running into a lot of stuff reading that series that was completely not in the anime, but at the same time, it's like, I understand that it's going to cut pacing here and I can get it. I can still read it and get it. So yeah. Anywho, except for any cut scenes of Roxy, any scene that was cut in the anime adaptation of Roxy, unacceptable.
Unacceptable.
Moving on. Your boy Kong Min or Kome, or Patapi Kome. This one streamed on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio PA Works, based off of a manga. Genres are comedy, drama, music, slice of life, supernatural. And this one follows, it takes place, or it starts out in the Three Kingdoms warring era, following Kome. From this point on, I'm going to be calling him Kome because that's how they pronounce it in the anime. Kome, and he is at his deathbed. He's passing away, and as he's passing away, he's like, you know, I kind of wish that I could be reborn into a world of peace that my master and generals have all wanted. What we all been fighting for is that world of peace. I hope I can have it. And sure enough, as he goes dark, he wakes up in the middle of current times, Tokyo, Japan, and they're currently, obviously, for some reason, celebrating Halloween at that particular time, so he quickly thinks that he's in hell. Like, there's people just dancing around in weird outfits. So he's like, I must be in hell. Well, that's a bummer. Somebody quickly grabs him and says, oh my gosh, you're a perfect looking Kome. And they drag him into some nightclub where he ends up seeing Eiko on the stage performing her song. And he's quickly entranced by her vocals. Even so much that when she gets off stage, he's like, you've entranced me. She's like dressed up as like a demon or succubus kind of looking girl. And so he immediately thinks that she's a demon that's been trying to entrance him. But later on, Eiko, after work, ends up stumbling upon Kome drunk on the side of an alleyway. For some reason, girl takes him home, as girls do take old people home with them when they're drunk on the side of the road. But she's a good heart. She's got a good heart. Just girls don't do that. Bring Kome all the way to her apartment, and next day he wakes up, and she kind of gives him a full catch-up of what's been going on, like technology and everything. He's obviously trying to convince her that he's not really trying to convince her, but telling her that he's Kome, even though she doesn't believe it. But gets him fully updated on technology and the modern times and obviously what happened to his generals and stuff that he left behind. And the thing that kind of comes from this is that Kome, on one hand, is just captivated by music, especially Eiko's music. There's some of it that he doesn't quite understand. But at the same time, she's bestowed information upon him that he feels like he needs to repay by bestowing, like, using that knowledge to benefit her. So he decides, like, shortly after this, that he is going to become Eiko's tactician. Not really manager, tactician. The great tactician Kome is going to become this singer's tactician to make her succeed. Like, he says, do you want to succeed? Do you want 100,000 followers? What do you want? I will make it happen. And so this up-and-coming musician has Kome, the tactician, at her side, going to different venues and using his knowledge as a tactician to kind of benefit. So they'll often have in certain episodes, or pretty much every episode, very beginning, they'll have like a little bit of a quick, very quick history lesson about something that Kome has done in Legends, and then utilizing that pretty much in the sense of a venue or something like that, where you have, you know, multiple stages and the flow of, you know, people will get stuck at one stage. Well, he'll figure out some way of, you know, making the flow of attendees go to Echo's performance instead. It's that kind of stuff, and it gets really, really kind of goofy and interesting in that regard. But yeah, your thoughts on Kome? Kome specifically. No, <I'm> sorry.
I enjoyed this show. When all is said and done, there was a part of it that I want to say in the middle, towards the three quarters part, that I felt kind of
the finding the voice part.
I don't want to say it was that. It there was somewhere in there that that I just kind of fell off for a little while. I powered through it, and I did come away enjoying the show overall. When it comes down to it, it's one of those that's kind of frustrating. I do really enjoy the music, and there was a lot of solid music in this show. I enjoyed a lot of the characters, the character development and the characters, especially the latter, some of the latter characters that were added into the final arc per se. I really enjoyed them. I found myself enjoying the rapper and a lot of the stuff involved with him. I very much enjoyed, and probably the most I enjoyed was Nanami and her group. So it's one of those mixed bags, for lack of a better term, but I generally, overall, I really did enjoy the show. I loved the character development, loved the characters, loved the story. Koming is one of those that, yeah, I liked him. I liked how they translated a lot of, like Andrew was mentioning, his tactics and his strategies, translated it into kind of effectively, for what Andrew was saying, using those strategies to kind of direct people and how they view things and what's going on around them. I enjoyed how that entire thing was kind of utilized. Overall, he didn't really add that much to me. Overall, I really enjoyed the characters and how they developed in themselves. Yeah, you could say that Kong Ming was enticing them to do things, but to me, he was just kind of the puppeteer in the background. And
like the tactician?
Yeah, he was the tactician. So when it comes down to it, I overall, I liked the show. It was an enjoyable show.
Yeesh. I thought Chris would enjoy this a lot more than that. I absolutely love this show. Is that how you say it? I love this show.
You love this show?
Yes, okay. I'm gonna take it from Chris. I love this show. Really, really love this show. And it was surprising how much I enjoyed it. What's funny is how much I enjoyed it more and differently than I thought I was from the very beginning, looking into it in the previews and stuff like that. The previews is like, I'm looking forward to singing waifu girl, blonde hair cutie that's gonna dance on the stages. There's gonna be some goofball next to her that's gonna be doing his own thing. It's going to be a fish out of water story, comedy constantly, you know, what's a cell phone, that kind of stuff. And the moment I start up the show, I immediately fell in love with Kome. Kome was, I'm thinking like, okay, here's dorky guy with doofy glasses, all the cover arts and stuff like that. This is going to be a goofball. This is going to be basically the old man trying to be, you know, hello fellow kids kind of thing. No, Kome was literally the draw of this show, especially early on for me. And I couldn't explain it other than the fact that I felt like he was a refreshing insert into modern times. This idea of somebody that sees not that he is in servitude to Echo, not that he is trying to make a transaction with Echo, not that he's going to work for her, but that he's going to benefit her for benefiting him and use his knowledge and the way that he sees things differently to benefit Echo. And especially early on, really hitting heavy on the idea that it's trying to... He's essentially what Echo was seeking to do. Echo had given up on life, and she was about to jump in front of a train, I believe it was. And then her manager pulls her into this nightclub where this foreign singer's singing, and this foreign singer just blows her away and changes her life. And she wants to kind of do that same thing for other people. And she doesn't realize that Komei was pretty much the first person she did that to. He had realized he lost all of his companions from his previous life, and he knows the results of all that stuff, and they're no longer around. And she kind of pulled him out of that darkness with her voice. And he kind of wanted to help benefit her to moving forward. But he always sees things differently than her. His values and everything are so much different than the people around him. And I almost feel like that's kind of helps in his tacticians. But yes, it's always his use of his knowledge that's always kind of really goofily laid out, you know, creating the room that is confusing to exit from, and which is like this whole famous strategy that he used with these pillars. Those are always kind of interesting, but I never got stuck in them. Like, I never really care. I do want to get into a lot of Three Kingdoms based manga and anime, but I'm not like a geek in that stuff, so it's not as if I get really invested in that stuff, but it was always a nice driving force for how they were taking the story and the direction it was taking it. What's crazy is, as the show went along, and they introduced Kabe, who's the rapper, and I was like, what is this guy? Like, why are they suddenly introducing rapping into the story? And then it's like, holy crap, what they did with Kabe. And of course, the rap battle was fantastic. Bringing Kabe into the mix was, like, perfect. And it went even higher at the very end of the show when I realized that everything was for a purpose. Like, it was almost as if everything that Komei was putting together was, like, for the strategy for that end game. Like, the very last episode, or the last two episodes. That when they came around, I was like, holy crap, I know what the writer's doing right here. And if they pull this off, I mean, it was pulling off the first part in the 11th episode. And then it gets in the 12th episode, I'm like, you nailed it. like this writer and the studio nailed it. Obviously, it's PA Works, so it looks really fantastic. It's not PA Works' best visually. Like, they didn't go for a lot of really crazy photorealistic filters and stuff like that. But it definitely has their style. But they pulled it off. Like, they pulled off the ending so well. And my gosh, the music. Like, whoever worked behind the scenes for... I'm assuming it probably had multiple people working on it, because you had pop, you had rock, you had rap, all these different styles that they were kind of introducing into this, and they had so many cover songs for so many really fantastic older titles. It all culminates into, like, a perfect package. I will agree with Chris, and I think it's probably a different point, but my point specifically was the find your own voice segment for Eiko. I've never cared for that storyline. I mean, I understand the idea of somebody trying to find their own. It felt like she had her purpose to begin with. Like, she had a driving force, but you can argue that it was copying somebody else's driving force. The idea of, well, I wouldn't say it was copying, because she didn't know what that foreign singer was trying to help her save her life kind of thing. But she had a purpose. Like, she had a goal. Like, I want to sing for people just like this person saved my life. And I felt like her going through this whole montage of I have to find my own voice was just kind of... It was obviously an excuse for her to meet Nanami. But at the same time, it was like... It felt like it lulled there. And Kabe was doing the same thing. It was him trying to discover something as well. And that was like the only part where I felt like it lulled a little bit. But it came to a very, very awesome ending that I absolutely adored. So besides maybe a couple of episodes in there, It was just a really great show, and I absolutely loved it to death. So I highly recommend this series. I loved it to death. And I think if you're watching the first couple episodes and Komei doesn't really hit it for you, you might decide otherwise, but I really enjoyed it. It was a huge surprise for me. Like I said, coming into this, I expected, you know, cute Eiko waifu, but I got so much more from it. So yeah, good stuff. Highly recommend Parepi Komei.
You fell in love with Komei, so.
Yes, Komei is great. I love Keiko too. Eiko power. Anyways, moving forward, we have Aharen-san is Indecipherable, or Aharen-san wa Hakaranai. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Felix Film. Source is a manga. These genres are comedy, romance, slice of life. This one follows Raido, and Raido is starting a new year, and Raido has a thing about him that everybody believes that he's, like, a delinquent. He's got those eyes that you'd usually get from those delinquent characters in anime, but at some point he's like, you know, I need to make friends, and why not start with my neighbor in class? She seems like she doesn't really, you know, talk to many people, and that's Aharen. And Aheren's like this really short girl, very, very quiet. And he keeps trying to make conversation with her. She keeps looking at him and then looking away, and he thinks that she's ignoring him. But come to find out, as she gets really close to him to talk to him, she just doesn't project her voice very well. She's very quiet. As we find out later on, Aheren had some unfortunate events with her past friends where they thought that she was too clingy and too loud. So she's kind of afraid of making new friends and afraid of scaring people away by being too loud. So it kind of turns into a montage of Raito trying to figure out ways of communicating to Aheren, because obviously she's very quiet and she's afraid of being vocal, and becoming friends through that trial, and include other characters like Ashiro, who really badly wants to protect Aheren but never wants to get close to her because she's afraid that she's going to get mad at her. And her brother and sister, and then Futaba, who's this goofy girl that thinks that Aheren's taking away this crush that she has from her because this boy Akun thinks that Aheren is his shisho because they played games together and she's really good at it. So your thoughts on Aheren-san is indecipherable.
I love this show.
Is it because Raito? I'm joking.
No, this is an absolutely adorable, cute show. I love the main leads. A lot of the supporting cast is absolutely fantastic. The humor in the show is, to me, really good. It hits when it wants to make something funny. There was very rarely a time that the jokes didn't hit for me, and I think that's at least a testament to me of absolutely fantastic comedic writing. Is for the most part, me not feeling a joke, it doesn't. I still would chuckle here and there of something that it didn't like make me roll on the floor the entire show. But at least I could enjoy the times even when I wasn't laughing out loud. I just in general, I really did love the humor in this show, and the cuteness of these two characters enjoying each other when it comes down to it. It was really well done.
Yeah, I would call it like a smile show. Like this is one of those shows where it's not like a laugh out loud show. It's a smile show because they're just Raito and Aheren are like so cute together, and it quickly establishes the idea of like a contrast between like this really tall, you know, grumpy looking character. He's not that he's grumpy; he's grumpy looking, and then having this very short, cute, adorable girl that's just very quiet. Just like the chemistry between the two of them is just perfect. And I keep doing this, and I know it probably angers some people. This is pretty much the Komi-san can't communicate that I wanted. Like, this is the girl that can't really communicate very well, but then having, like, a male character that's, like, prominent. Like, Raito is a solid main character. Like, he's there, he's present, it's not all about Aheren. Raito, what's funny is most of the comedy comes in Raito's imagination of Aheren. It's not necessarily that it is, you know, Raito is just this character that's staying there doing something every now and then. With the whole thing of her communication, there's a huge montage of him trying to figure out ways of communicating to Aheren. It's smoke screens, it's sign language. He's doing everything he can in order to communicate with her. He's trying to go that extra mile to help her. And in a sense, that creates that relationship because Aheren realizes what all Raito's doing for her. And I think that's just super cute between the two of them. And she's always trying to repay him, and she fails miserably at it. Okay, well, I made this food, so I'm going to stay up all night trying to make food so that I can give him more food. And then, yeah, failing miserably at feeding that food to him. She's adorable. Aheren is just kind of... I wouldn't say that she's like... she's obviously moe cute kind of thing with like the klutziness, but it's always kind of this overstretching herself at the same time. Again, the miscommunications between the two of them, because obviously Raito always thinks that she's needs something, and so he goes out the extra mile to make it happen, but then it always ends up being just kind of a simple thing that Aheren can do to resolve the situation. That's really a lot of the funniness that comes from the show, is just, like I said, overblowing situations and miscommunication, I would say, like misreading each other kind of thing, has always been a lot of fun, and they're just absolutely adorable together. And yeah, it technically has a really solid payoff at the end, which I think a lot of these shows don't really have, that I really did enjoy. But this is a really great cast of characters, too. I think the only character I didn't like was the teacher, Tobaru. Her joke was like, we could have done this in one scene, but no, we have to keep bringing her back into the show to have her. She's a teacher that sees Ahedin and Raito and, like, overblows everything they do together as, like, being some really crushy, mushy-mushy thing, and then she'll start bleeding out her nose and then passing out. And it's like, I got a kick out of it the first time she did it in the class, and she, you know, right? They would sit close to each other, and then she's, like, freaking out, and then the Raito would put Ahedin on his shoulder so that she can see the chalkboard, and then she would literally almost pass out and have to leave the room. It was funny, like, the first time, and then it's like, every time she comes up on the scene, it's like, oh, God, we're doing this again. Yes, bleed out your nose. Yes, other teacher, freak out. We get it. We get it. We don't need, this is, like, literally the same joke. We're not doing anything different with it.
Yeah, she didn't
add much. That was the only, like, woof part of the entire site. Futaba, I loved to death. Like, she was super cute. And her, like, again, technically thinking ahead and as a rival, for this girl that she has, this boy that she has a crush with, and just her constantly being at Ahedin and then realizing at some point that Ahedin's trying to help her out, and then she can't admit to it kind of stuff. The brother and the sister, Eru and Ren, were super cute. Loved them. Of course, Tama voicing Ren. Obviously, Chris probably really enjoyed that part.
Oh, I absolutely... I made the joke about the fact that because of... I'm to try and be careful with it is... I absolutely loved the addition of a Tama version of Aharen and yeah, special.
Yeah, yeah, it was good. It was really good. I even thought Ishikawa and Saito was great as well. They were kind of the Cupids. They were the Cupids. Oshiro, I really enjoyed. I thought her timidness was really super cute. There was times where she got kind of annoying with her story, but I did like the aspect that she was always afraid that Ahedin was going to get mad at her. Ahedin is like some like vicious person that will beat the crap out of her if she steps out of line. Like, she doesn't let Raito around, but she knows if she got rid of Raito, then Ahedin would get mad at her. It was goofy. So, really solid cast, really cute show. If you're looking for a cutesy little rom-com, definitely check it out. Again, not super laugh-out-loud comedy, in my opinion, but really solid. I think I said it when we were doing our first impressions, but I kind of want to go back and watch Denkigai again, because obviously this is from the same mangaka that did Denkigai. And I kind of drifted away from Denkigai really quickly, even though I kind of wanted to finish it. I do like this character artist, or at least the mangaka for this character designs. I kind of feel like it works better here as like this, you know, cute scroll girl rather than, again, technically a bunch of adults working at a comic book store all looking like little children, but it definitely makes me want to go back and check that out again, because I don't think I gave it much chance. So, but yeah, that's Ahedin-san is indecipherable, or Ahedin-san wa hakaranai, because for some reason Crunchyroll did not want to translate that. I'm not sure if is indecipherable is a copyrighted title or not, but it is what it is. Moving on, we have The Executioner and Her Way of Life, or Shoke Shoujo no Virgin Road. This one is streaming on HIDIVE, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio JC Staff. This source is a light novel. The genres are action, adventure, drama, fantasy. And this one takes place in a fantasy world, where essentially people of different groups will summon people from other worlds, which, yes, happens to be from our current time, Japan. And after they summon people to this other world, those people come over with an ability. They call these people the Otherworlders that they summon over. And every Otherworlder has an ability that they obtain when they transport to this world. And so that can be just any number of different abilities. The very beginning, we follow, we see this guy, Mitsugi, which eventually we find out that he thinks that he doesn't have an ability. They say that his ability is null, like he has no ability. But, yes, as it kind of led you to believe, null means to erase the existence of something. So he can create like a ball of void that just makes things disappear. Well, in this world, they have different classes. They have the Faust, which are the highest class, the most powerful. It's pretty much the church. You have the royalty, which is typically, which is the noblesse. And then you have the other one, I think, is just commoners. But currently when we open up, the Faust are essentially the ones of power, and they have these secret people known as the executioners that will go out, find out if somebody is summoning somebody to this world, kill that person, and then hold them accountable for the summoning. It's pretty much taboo to summon people in this world. Because we find out many years ago, there was these events known as the four human errors, which is four situations where somebody was summoned over, because they used to summon people all the time, bring in technology, bring in knowledge, they have powers, they can be the heroes of this world. Well, eventually, those powers went crazy, because as they find out, the more these other worlders use their abilities, the more they lose memories and their mind, and eventually their power will go out of control. And like I said, these four instances, known as the four human errors, was four cases where somebody's power went crazy. So again, it's taboo to summon people. They don't want it to happen anymore. So the Faust pretty much have these executioners go out, find and kill these other worlders. Well, we follow Minnow, who's one of the executioner. Like the very beginning, she pretty much, from the very beginning, Minnow will find, there's this girl, Akari, that was summoned by these nobles, and she goes to kill Akari. But come to find out, Akari not only has the ability to heal herself, which she thinks initially is the case, but she actually has the power to rewind time, and it automatically happens when she kills Akari. So she has to figure out some way of finding a way to kill Akari. She can't just test out a bunch of stuff, because like I said, the more she uses her ability, the more it'll go out of control. So she has to discover some way to get rid of her. At the very beginning, one of the leaders of the Faust has her bring her over to this temple they have to get rid of her there. So kind of turns into a journey of Minnow traveling with Akari to try to find some way of killing Akari. Well, Akari believes that Minnow just wants to be, you know, take her to a safe place to send her back home. So, yeah. Your thoughts?
I generally really enjoyed this show. There's a lot of really cool things in the world of this show. I enjoyed a lot of the character development between Minnow and Akari. This being the kind of main central focus of the show, of kind of getting into the background between those two characters. Getting into Pandora and the latter part of the series was kind of interesting. I kind of hate the fact that it kind of ended the way it did. It felt very, very cut off. It was really frustrating the way that they kind of ended it the way they did. It's one of those things that you really want. This is one of those shows that you feel like the prototype of a kind of a manga bait or a light novel bait type show, where they kind of bring in a lot of the kind of more bigger intricacies of this world and just kind of leave it the way it is. And so I am very frustrated at the ending of this show. But overall, I did like a lot of the things that they kind of introduced. The fascinating concepts that they had involved with the isekai characters are not necessarily the good things, but in a lot of cases, they're not necessarily, it's not their fault for who they are. But yeah, that's kind of where I lay with this. I'm kind of middle of the road. I enjoyed it. I thought it was a very fascinating take on the isekai. But yeah.
Yeah, I'm kind of the initial draw of this show is definitely the idea of a different vantage point of isekai. Typically, isekai go into the world, superpowered, all that kind of stuff. This is like the vantage point of, at least from the very beginning, it kind of shifts away from that quite a bit. But is the vantage point of the people that have to deal with those overpowered isekai characters coming to their world and honestly ruining it. And I agree the idea that the initial kind of stinger was the fact that it lives in a gray area, and the idea that Minnow doesn't really want to kill these people, but at the same time, they kind of have to. Because as I mentioned earlier, they have cases in the past where entire kingdoms were wiped out because another worlder came there, lost control of their ability, and destroyed an entire area. And in the case with the first interaction that Minnow really has with somebody, is like, well, they had this brief moment where they say they can erase anybody that opposes them, and it's like, you're a threat. It's gone. Like, it's not even a question at that point. I mean, you technically see it with Akari later on. It's like, they're running out, and all of a sudden, boop, dead. Like, Minnow can't really, hesitate, because every single one of these people is literally a threat. And she even apologizes, like, this is not your fault. I killed you because it's not your fault there's no choice here. We don't know of a way to go send you back. It can only lead to destruction. There's no alternative. You will use your ability. You will lose your mind. You will go out of control, and you will destroy possibly the entire world. They can't deal with that threat. And so it's always this like gray area of, man, this feels really bad that they literally have to kill these people. And these people, it's not their fault. Like, they didn't choose to come there. They were summoned there beyond their own control. And now they're here and they just have to be killed. It feels, the only people that are bad guys, obviously, are the people that are summoning. That's the obvious bad guys here, because they're pulling people in and putting them in threat. So that gray area was definitely the pull initially. Learning more about Akari and really kind of diving into the concept of the ability that Akari has and how that can kind of shape the narrative was very interesting as well. I had a lot of fun really kind of speculating on stuff around Akari. Obviously, Minnow is not an idiot, so she was figuring out just about the same time I was, so I didn't really feel like I was that smart. It kind of does that whole thing where you're trying to theorize on something, and suddenly Minnow's like, yeah, I figured that out, and you're like, well, crap, I don't feel like I'm figuring things out. But at the same time, it's allowing you to kind of learn as it goes along. And I did kind of feel like early on, man, they're revealing so much about this world and Akari and all this kind of stuff. I feel like we're running out of material really quickly. But sure enough, like, jumping into the second arc, well, I felt like the beginning segments of the second arc, when we got to the seaside and we start getting into Manon and the fourth, which is another group of people that believe that they are another. There's the Faust, the Noblest, and the Commoners. The fourth are basically people that claim themselves being separate from that class system. And when I started getting that stuff, I was kind of getting a little worried. Like, I didn't feel like there was enough. It wasn't that interesting at the very beginning of it. But as it starts to get into who Manon is, I was afraid that she'd just be a, you know, your master killed my mom kind of thing. But it turned into something so much more. And I got really interested in it. That's what sucks, because as it gets really interesting and it gets more information and more world building and more insight into the human errors and everything on the outside of the storyline, it just stops. I was like, damn it. Why are you revealing so much stuff at the end of this show? And I know you're not going to get into any of it. That's the big butt in this whole thing. I love this show to death. I love the characters. I freaking love the style. Like, I love Manon's design. I think a lot of these characters, like, Momo's fantastic. She's like the best Yandere I've seen in a long time. Just her literally saying that she'll destroy everything just for the sake of Minnow. That scene was just probably easily my favorite scene of this entire season, was just Momo going nuts and literally nearly blowing up everybody. Was so good. Ashina was fantastic. She's just, I love her princess carrying somebody. Ashina's fantastic. I love all these characters. They're so fantastic. The style's great. JC Staff did a phenomenal job in the animation. Big props to them. Besides the centipede thing, CGI at the very end of it, everything else looked fantastic. The fight scenes are so good. These are fight scenes that aren't just simply I create bigger light beam than you create and thus I win. These are like really strategized out fight scenes, and I love how like Minnow uses scripture from her book, and the scripture is like religious text, but the scripture itself creates the magic. So the example I always give is like the moment she said something about the non-believers will hear the toll of the bell. This huge bell shows up and it chimes and it literally just like vibrates and can kill people. It's that kind of cool stuff that comes from the scripture that creates power. And then, yeah, her dagger, she can channel aether through her dagger and explode and all this kind of stuff. It's really, really cool. The fight scenes themselves are really interesting how they lay out. Everything about this show, I love. I love everything. It's so fascinating. But yes, that ending, it's the way I describe it, it's one of those endings where this needs a second season. It desperately needs a second season, because it does have this really nasty sour taste at the very end, because it starts in episode 11, honestly, but on into episode 12, it's constantly revealing things that lead into things in the future. It is, unless it gets a second season, kind of classic source material bait. Not that I am kind of mad. It's not that I'm like furious, but it is one of those ones where it's like, gosh dang, I kind of hate that they show these things that they're obviously not going to get into yet. It's a solid chapter close. It feels like it started turning the page a little bit too far into the next chapter, which does frustrate me a little bit. But I think it's still, in the end, one of those ones where, despite that sour at the end, especially if you're fine with getting a light novel, I still highly recommend the show. I really did enjoy it. It was a great ride. I love the characters, love the action, and I just loved digging into each and every single episode. But yeah, that's The Executioner in a Way of Life. Check that out. No. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Science Fell in Love, So I Tried to Prove It, second season. Streamed on Crunchyroll, run for 12 episodes, done by Studio Zero G. Sources of manga. Genres are comedy, romance. Scientists fall in love and they try to prove it. Anything special in the second season?
To me, I thought that the humor in this particular season, this is about basically our two main characters kind of quote-unquote falling in love, and then they sit there and they banter back and forth on how they can prove scientifically whether or not somebody has actually fallen in love. And if for those of you who have been listening long enough, when the first season came around, I was kind of mixed on the aspect of the humor in the show. When they actually do have some kind of humor moments, kind of digging into some kind of a trope or something like that, they do that kind of well. Where they kind of lose me in a lot of cases is the sciencey side, which I understand why it's there. This show's shtick is to have the kind of sciencey aspect involved in everything. This season didn't really get away from that formula. But they did play on a lot of the tropes. And what really did, I did really enjoy was a couple of the side characters really became a lot more in the prominent, section. After the first kind of, getting through the spit, the chemicals in the spit, they did go into a couple of the other side characters and started digging into them a bit more. And I did find the one couple was really done well. The last one I thought was fantastic. They got into one of the characters that's in the main cast, but she's not really she's not very prominent. But they got to digging into her and her psyche and why she was doing what she was doing, and then kind of gave a mirror of her. And I don't want to dig too much into it. Those of you who have watched, you understand what I'm saying. They did a mirror of this character, and I thought they did fantastic with it and really did bring out why this is not necessarily good thinking, but if this is who you are, be you. And I thought that was really fantastically done. So yes, nice little bow to this show that, for lack of a better term, I've always been kind of mixed on. I do like their humor. When they do their humor and when they dig into tropes, I think they do fantastic. When they get stuck in the science, it doesn't really work for me. It might work for others. If you like the kind of, sciencey aspect, it might work for you. It doesn't really work for me. But all in all, I'm fine with the show. It's doing fine. It keeps doing what it does, and it does it well.
Yeah, I think that was what kind of pushed me away from the first season, was just the, all right, now let's look at flowcharts and different wavelengths and super geeky stuff. It's like, okay, gotcha. Get back to the cute girls. Science Fell in Love, So I Try to Prove It, second season. Check that out if that's interesting to you. Danse Danse Danseur. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll. Ran for 11 episodes. Studio is MAPPA. Sources of manga. Genres are drama, romance, slice of life, sports. And this one follows Junpei. And Junpei is kind of shows a little bit of backstory and the idea that his father was like a coordinator for stunts and stuff like that. And at some point, Junpei decided that he wanted to get into ballet after they went to this performance and seen this guy perform on the stage, and he's seen these sparkle, sparkle kidas happening around the guy. So he desired to essentially recreate that feeling that he was getting watching this guy perform. So he wanted to get into ballet, obviously. Boys aren't supposed to be in ballet. Quickly, even though he wanted to, unfortunately, his father passed away, and he kind of was told by his uncle, I believe it was, that he needed to be the man of the house now. He needs to take care of his mom and his sister. And so Junpei, seeing what men need to be, kind of immediately thinks of his father, how his father was into karate. And not karate, it was something like judo or something like that. And so he decides that he's going to get that, become the manly man, take care of his family kind of thing. So he kind of gives up on ballet. Well, he still kind of knows the moves and stuff like that, so he still like performs it here and there, and immediately catches the attention of Miyako, this pretty girl in his school or his class. And Miyako, you know, quickly comes in and says, you know, I need you to come with me, and drags him all the way to her mother's studio where they learn ballet. And Junpei's like, you know, hey, look, I thought this girl just liked me. I don't really want to learn ballet, but he kind of keeps going there because he kind of likes Miyako and wants to, and thinks that she has a crush on him. Until eventually he kind of realizes, you know, hey, there's that sparkle, sparkle kia that I remember seeing at this performance. He kind of wants to do ballet. Like he still has that feeling like he wants to perform ballet and have that feeling again, sparkle inside of him. So I kind of follow him as he reluctantly learns ballet while at the same time trying to get with this girl, and eventually kind of including some other styles of ballet and a little bit of conflict in the leaderships of the actual schools themselves, and kind of Junpei having a kind of a knack for ballet despite the fact that he's not always been working at it, and like the conflict that people around him kind of have. Some people have spent their entire lives learning ballet, and the conflicts they see in Junpei being as skilled as he is but not refined as much as he should be, obviously because he hasn't been practicing it all of his life, just doing it as fun. So your thoughts?
I do like this show. It is really well done. It has a lot of the, for lack of a better term, it has a lot of the feel. When we first got into this, Welcome to the Ballroom obviously immediately came into
those necks.
Yeah, that was immediately the calling that I got out of this, was that this was a...
It was like, this has got to be the same mangaka. No. It's got to be the same character artist. No. Got to be the same studio. No.
It had a lot of the same feel, and I immediately was drawn to it. I really wanted to dig into this show. I was so excited about this, and I'm afraid that I may have overhyped myself on it, because when all was said and done... And I don't know if it's maybe because it was more focused into the ballet and that didn't work for me. I don't know what it was, but it did not hit the same as Welcome to the Ballroom. But that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just that it's doing something different. And I, in some ways, I was a bit frustrated with it, but at the same time, it doesn't do bad. It's a very good looking show. It's doing kind of a mix of going between contemporary and classical and different styles, and whether or not
Japan versus Russian,
Japan versus Russian. it's going a lot of, can you enjoy yourself if you are focusing too much on your own artistic feel, or if you're going into keeping the tradition of ballet involved?
That was the biggest struggle that I kind of felt with the whole thing. It almost paints a really nasty picture of ballet, and the idea that Junpei just kind of wanted... But, I mean, that's everything. Everybody wants to do their own thing, but it feels like he's kind of thrown into this battle between two different styles when he just wants to do his own thing. Like, he just wants to enjoy ballet, and it's like, you can't. Like, you it was at some point, they literally say, choose. Like, they're literally saying, you choose. Okay, well, then go away. It's like, woof! Like, woof! Does it have to be that clear-cut? Sorry.
But no, you're right, and that is the frustrating thing, is in a lot of cases, I don't know how to explain it. I as an antagonist, a lot of the characters who are kind of painted as such are really kind of frustrating. Luo, while I seen his rivalry with Junpei, I seen it and it was fine. It didn't really work well for me. A lot of the other characters that are introduced as kind of antagonists, for lack of a better term, they didn't really work well to me. In a lot of cases, this is the frustrating thing. Okay, what I just laid out as the main focus of this show, of contemporary versus classical, like Andrew had mentioned, Russian versus Japanese ballet, all this stuff is kind of the quote-unquote reason for the antagonism. And this is what gets frustrating in the end, is how do you... what they're laying out is going against the system. And it's not a good system, per se, that you can go against. I understand it. I understand what they were trying to do. It wasn't working in this, quote-unquote, in this story, per se. Is Junpei has a natural talent for it, obviously. And because he's the main protagonist, he has
overpowered main character.
Yeah, he has the most overpowered. And so people will naturally automatically acknowledge him, per se. Yeah, except for the idiot lady who absolutely refuses anything that is not absolutely perfect classical Japanese or perfect classical Russian top tier ballet dancer. If you're not that, you're crap, obviously.
Gotta be refined. He's a tough blade, but he's not refined.
Exactly. And that's really what it comes down to. Is to me, while it was a good story, it wasn't the issue of weight in a lot of the situations didn't quite pay off. Junpei is not the type of character that goes, I see what you're, he's embracing everything involved with ballet. He's not
that
going.
That was the weird part, which I don't think it's a negative so much.
Exactly.
He's a little too accepting, but it does, it's to your point, the conflicts aren't really there because he's so accepting of situations. Like, he definitely does take directions or turns in directions that I don't really expect. And the idea that typically with a lot of these stories, when faced with, you know, you have to choose this or this, it's kind of like the, do the fallback or do the trusted side, or obviously this is the choice he's going to make. He never really does. Like, he does keep kind of pushing forward into things that it's almost like he's almost like a dog that has a smell and he keeps going after that smell. And it often drives him in directions that you don't really kind of expect. Early on, it was all about Miyako. He's sniffing towards that Miyako. This sounds really bad. He's sniffing towards that Miyako, and he has to keep going to that one place because he keeps smelling Miyako there. And then eventually, he gets that kind of the whiff of, you know, again, technically, this lady that does not accept what he does. Doesn't accept his style. And he has to try to prove himself to her. He's got that smell, and he keeps going there. And he keeps going there. And everybody's mad because he keeps coming there, even though he's not taking it serious. Like, he's not there for the ballet that they've been striving for. They're not there for the, you know, the scholarship. He's there because of that smell. And they get mad because they keep showing up. Like, he's literally all about that smell. That tweak, the sparkle kira thing. And it does kind of make it frustrating. Like, literally, early on, Junpei is kind of annoying. Like, Junpei is not a likable character, especially early on. He's obsessed with Miyako, and it's like, dude, seriously, chill. Like, dude, seriously, chill. We all know why Miyako's pulling you there. But he's like super like into that. And then the moment that it kind of crashes on him, he gets all mad. It's like, dude, this guy's, Junpei is not likable early on. He overlooks bullying happening around Luo, and obviously why. He doesn't want to shake his friends and cause himself to be outcast. It's obviously a fear that comes around bullying and stuff that's around you. And it's kind of to a credit of the writer that they're willing to kind of stick him in that position where he doesn't speak up. He's not a hero. He's not going to step up and be the good person and save the bullied person because he doesn't technically like Ludo. So why would he stop the bullying when he doesn't like the dude? He's not going to join in, but he's not going to stop it. He is very unlikable at the very beginning. But I do like that, I guess the writer is willing to kind of put him in that position because you do kind of see him grow, and that's usually, and it's typically through kind of these really, yeah, I would agree, these moments of him not really seeing backlash for what he does. He literally makes a mockery of Godai's entire school because of the performance that he did. Doing his own thing, shaking up the performance, trying to put himself in the front of the stage, and basically being a mockery to, technically, the Japanese style of ballet that she doesn't want to recognize, but literally making that school look bad. They were pulling kids out of her school. Like, and it's like, it doesn't really necessarily go, wow, I screwed up. It's, well, I'm going to prove myself to her. It's like, dude, you're not helping the situation. What are you doing? It's very juvenile in how Junpei thinks. And I think it's interesting, but at the same time, kind of a little frustrating. And that gets more into the later parts. But I think overall, it made it for an interesting main character that doesn't really do exactly what I would kind of figure that a main character would do. He does technically seek out what he's seeking out in what he thinks is the way of remedying it. And it's not always the best way because, again, it's typically juvenile. But that said, I do like kind of where the direction was taking it. Well, I was a little bit frustrated with the whole Japanese versus Russian ballet politics that gets involved there and not one side not wanting to acknowledge this side. Getting into Ryo and the kind of crap that he was put through as a child, struggling with his lack of parental figure. Not quite sure what they were doing with that whole thing, but that's there. It's a struggle for me, honestly. It's 11 episodes of kind of struggle because I want to like what the writer's doing, but at the same time, I struggle with certain things the writer's doing. But in the end, I was engaged and I really did like the story overall. Now, my frustration, even though I was really loving this show, honestly, I think for the half point, I would probably say a quarter into the show, I started getting hooked on this show, despite my issues, despite my getting frustrated with Junpei, because again, Junpei is an idiot kid. Despite my frustrations with this juvenile kid and the decisions that he makes, I really liked it. I was really liking the show. And then it started getting to that later, they kind of did something that I wasn't really expecting. But then they kind of did that whole thing where the artist gets too wrapped up in the performance. Like, you have that moment where the characters decide randomly, not on a stage, randomly to act out a performance. And it was super cheesy. And it was literally the writer trying to break up a certain relationship. And they chose to do it by them acting out the stage performance. It was like one of those, are you really doing this? Like, can you not just have the characters say they're upset and walk away? No, we have to make it into the characters getting lost in their performance, and that's the breakup. It was super cheesy and felt so, so out of left field. Very out. I don't know if it's the same in the manga, but it just felt very badly paced. It just kind of just, okay, now they're chasing each other. Now they're acting this performance out. Now I'm guessing these two are broke up. I don't know. I don't care. Like, it was super out of nowhere, and I really didn't like it. And that kind of continued to the end of it. The end of it really felt like, again, I can understand the character's choice and what they're doing, but he's obviously stepping into the next stage of his life. And it kind of does make me want another season to kind of continue it on, because I really feel where the story's going now. I would probably really like it, because I like what the direction they're going with the characters. And plus, I would think it would probably involve Oikawa a lot more, which I think she was fantastic. Like, the brief moment that we had with Oikawa, I really liked her character. She very much so jives with Junpei, and I think the two of them are going to be like, I think me and Chris are kind of on the same page with the direction it can go. They feel like they're the ones that could probably stand out with their own style and probably get away with it.
Yeah.
And I think that direction is what it was starting to build up with. And I was really liking that, despite the fact that they're being kind of pulled in two different directions, two different styles. It all comes down to me saying, I really do love this show. It's just there's these really nasty pinnacle points that make me really frustrated with how it's told, or at least junctions in the story. I think every time the story takes a junction where it turns or pivots, it's always rough. It's very rough, and it usually is because Junpei is a dumb kid. But I still think there's so much potential here that I really want to see more of. It's kind of the same. I do have a similar feel to something like Welcome to the Ballroom. It's a story that I don't think I would like. Like, if somebody came up to me and said, hey, I have a show about a guy that does ballet, I don't care. I'm going to watch this show over here. But as soon as I start watching it, I'm going, crap, I like this. There's a guy do ballet. Well, I don't want to watch dancing. I don't want to watch a show about a guy learning how to do, you know, ballroom dancing. And then I watch it. I really loved it. It's the same feeling there. I think they're both fantastic. They both need a second season. Where's Balk in the Ballroom season two, please?
Yeah. And I agree. A lot of this, for all of my quote-unquote bashing, if you want to call it that, I did really like the show. There's just these things in there that are just really kind of freaking annoying.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, same. Anyways, that's... I know I goofed up earlier, but it's dance here. So check that out if that's interesting to you. Moving on, we have Trapped in a Dating Sim. The world of Atome Games is tough for mobs, or Tomega Sekai wa Mob ni Kibishi Sekai Desu. This one streamed on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio ENGI. Source is a light novel. Genres are action, adventure, comedy, drama, fantasy, mecha, romance, everything under the bus. This one follows a guy that is in our current modern times, assuming Japan, yes, pretty much Japan. And at some point, his sister kind of forces him by blackmail to have to play an Atome game so that she can unlock the ending to it. She apparently probably already played it before, and so she wanted him to do it for her and get her the ending. Otherwise, she was going to reveal something to his parents that she found. And so he does it. Pretty much pulls a couple of all-nighters trying to get through the whole thing. Really hates it. Just hates the plot. It's, like, overblown. A lot of the fight scenes and stuff that you have to go through are really dumb. Hates the characters because the princes are all pretty boys that are dumb. And he doesn't like the ditzy main character. All the stuff that he hates about it. But he gets through it. And then he decides that he's going to go get a drink or something from the convenience store and falls down some stairs and dies. Well, then he wakes up. And, well, he pretty much wakes up into the mind of, it was like a 10-year-old or something like that. He was reborn in another world, but it took a while before, like, his memories of his previous life kind of unlocked, and he realized that he'd been isekai'd. And now he's in this other world, which he kind of figures out really quickly is the game that he played through. So he decides, you know, I'm just going to be a mob. I'm going to be, like, this non-played character, like, this side character that doesn't affect the game. And tries to just have a normal life, but unfortunately he is the son of a father who had some sort of marriage to some sort of noble lady that's, like, super, mean. Is going to find out this is kind of a matriarchy world where all the women have the power, and so he's kind of forced to have to get married to somebody he doesn't want to get married to, so he decides to make his own riches by using his knowledge of the game to find, like, these secret treasures in the world itself and get riches for himself so that he can make his own decisions. But it eventually leads him to have to get married either one way or another, which leads him to the academy where the actual Tome game takes place in. This is the area where the main female character comes to this academy. She's like she's a commoner, so she kind of gets a
scholarship of some
sort. I keep thinking that word, and I keep missing it. A scholarship to come to that academy. And in the game, she's, like, obviously seen as a commoner, but yet she, you know, using the right choices, eventually swoons over the princes. And, well, now that he's there, he realizes really quickly, oh, there's the girl that's the main character, and there's all the princes. But then quickly realizes there's a new person here, and she's doing all the lines that the main girl is supposed to be doing. So... But he's like, you know, I'm going to leave it be because I'm going to be a mob. I'm going to come here, find some random girl to get married to and move on with my life as a mob. But then quickly finds himself kind of getting pulled into the main characters anyways, because as he kind of finds out over time, again, this girl that's pulling all the strings that's not in the game is kind of causing a stir. And then eventually that leads to pretty much the main villain girl of the game, which is Angelica. Him kind of feeling sorry for the situation that she's being put through. And so he ends up stepping up and getting pretty much wrapped up in everything. So Your thoughts?
This one is an interesting kind of tidbit for this season. To say that this ended up being the surprise of the season would be an understatement by far. When we did the preview for this, it was like, this is an interesting take on the isekai genre. And so I definitely had my eye on it. But even that's downplaying this quite a bit, because when it started out, wasn't impressed by the visuals. It didn't really capture me as far as, doing anything vastly superior. It just kind of meandered. And then when it came down to it, the storyline for sure is really what kind of, pulled this show off. Like Andrew was saying, this is the main character is effectively a mob character. Well, he's a mob character, but he's not even supposed to be really involved in the main storyline of this Otome game. And so by virtue of him trying to stay out of all these situations, somehow he's becoming more and more involved in these situations. And this story actually pulls that off quite a bit. Especially as this other character who we have our speculations on who that character would be. That character is obviously trying to play the main heroine. And so the main heroine kind of gets left to the side in most of these cases. And then eventually, because of the girl taking the main heroine's spot, of course, the main antagonist gets kicked to the side. And so Leon, for all of his negative sides, he ends up being this really interesting kind of tidbit of a, really kind of a cool protagonist in a lot of cases. So it's really interesting how all of these things kind of played into this story, and I very much enjoyed it. All said and done, visuals are not that great, but when it comes down to it, I enjoyed the show a lot.
Yeah, I think the funny thing with this one is it's like a continuously shifting thought process to my feelings on the show itself. Like, it didn't start good at all. Like, the first episode was kind of boring. It's just literally him going, I want to stay out of everything. I'm going to go get overpowered with money, enjoy my life. And then it kind of shifts into the academy itself, where you start to get the intrigue of, like, okay, who's this Marie girl? This girl that's obviously taking the main role. And then it gets in this dumb, like, I was like one or two, I think it was a full episode of just nothing but really kind of dumb tournament fighting. And I'm like, okay, that kind of put a little stain back on it. And then it comes back again. It was a constant shift of, like, okay, I don't really care much for this. Okay, this is kind of getting interesting with, you know, again, twisting what this Otome game is and the story itself. And then, again, this really dumb tournament. And then really getting into, oh my gosh, I really like this character. Like, Leon is he's a jerk, but he's a jerk that does everything that you kind of want him to do. Like, when you think, oh gosh, he should give it to this person. He does. Like, he does. And the queen shows up and you're like, okay, queen's really cool. I like the queen. Like, he literally proposes to the queen in front of everybody. It's like he does exactly what you're kind of thinking in the back of your head, but you know is logically he shouldn't do. He does it. And I think that's what I really like about him. He's a jerk, but at the same time, he's a jerk that does what you kind of want a main character to do. He doesn't sit by and go, oh my gosh, I really shouldn't do this. Now, he does get annoying later on. I will admit that. It gets to a point where Leon essentially turns into the, I need to be the mob. I can't be involved. I need to be the mob. And it's like, you're already involved. Like, you constantly involve yourself, and then you act like you don't want to get involved. He's a little annoying like that. Like, I can't be a part of this story. Obviously, this girl kind of is following me around. She might... I don't think she likes me, because I can't be involved. It gets kind of annoying in that regard. He does feel like he's a little dumb when it comes to romance and, like, what he's essentially opened the door for. He's like legit the most staple version of I don't want to be involved, but yet I am literally the center of attention right now. And it does get frustrating in that regard. But I still like it in the end because he kind of is a likable mean dude. Now, what I wasn't really expecting was how interesting, how what they did with Olivia and Angelica, honestly. I really did feel like it kind of gives you a sense that they're just going to be kind of the two cute girls that get dragged along with his shenanigans. And they really were starting to do something very interesting with them. Olivia, more in the idea of what happens when your main role is taken. Like, what defines you when you no longer have something there to define you? And taking it to kind of an extreme. Now, I don't think that they nailed the execution at the end. It was cute, but I didn't feel like they did enough with it, despite the fact opening the door to something really interesting. Maybe it was just me expecting too much and then being a little bit let down, but I still think it was cute in the end. Angelica, I think, was the most interesting thing early on, is taking a character that is obviously seen as a villain in the original game and then turning her into pretty much, yes, a love interest, but more of like turning her into a character that you can kind of feel for. Like, you understand why she's a villain. In the game, it's just that she is in the way of the main heroine getting the prince. But then when you turn into an aspect of, well, this Maria girl is literally using a guidebook. Like, she's literally using all the right answers to get the princes. And yet Angelica's over here being essentially told that she's not respecting the prince enough because he doesn't understand her. Well, it's like, well, Marie is literally using cheats. It's not like she understands you, but the prince thinks that she understands him. And getting into that stuff is kind of interesting. Like, it does technically take the aspect of a dating sim game, a Tome game, and really twisting it in a very interesting way. Again, having really solid characters to kind of drive it forward. Now, with all that said, I do want to say that the ending was, it goes to a really crazy, you know, climax, and there's something really significant happening, but I feel like this one itching thing in the middle was never really answered, and it bugs me. Now, granted, they already kind of ruined the reveals for that, which is what's the identity of Marie? And they kind of just jumped episodes and then did some inner monologue with her and just kind of revealed it. And it felt very anticlimactic. Like, they could have done something really cool to reveal that. But there's still another question that comes with that character. We never got it. And it's like, okay, well, that kind of sucks. But, I mean, again, we can kind of assume what that identity is. But, I don't know, I kind of felt that was a little anticlimactic. But, like I said, the way they twisted this Otome stuff around, what they did with the princes was kind of interesting. And the idea of them all basically being deceived and yet kind of backfiring on Marie a little bit. Again, Olivia and Angelica really enjoyed their kind of story arcs. And Leon, like I said before, is just a really solid main character that I really enjoyed. So it's a mess. it's a real mess that doesn't really come to anything like super satisfying in the end. But I did enjoy the journey just because, again, I liked all the weird stuff that they kind of did with this particular setup. I mean, we've had dating sim games, we've had Next Life as a Villainous and stuff, but this definitely took it from a different vantage point that I thought was really interesting and very entertaining in the end. So it's a suggestion for me. Yeah, I agree with Chris. Doesn't look the greatest. I agree with a lot of people that the original character designs from the light novel and manga looked fantastic, and I kind of wish that they did those instead, but they for some reason chose to go the route that they did, which doesn't make any sense to me, but it is what it is. It's not really, I'm sure they had some reasoning for their choice. I don't know what it is, but they're still cute. Like, the characters were still cute though.
It's one that definitely needs more. Sure. I mean, this is one of those that I probably will go to the light novel for this if I don't get some kind of satisfaction later, because there's so much that I definitely want to dig into on this one. This one is really interesting in the way that they pulled off a lot of the stuff that they did.
Yep. Moving on from Trapped in a Dating Sim, we have Halo Girl. Halo Girl streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Studio 3 Hertz, and the source is an original. The genres are music, fantasy, slice of life. And this one follows Kana, Remy, and Hibiki. And these are three apprentice healer girls. As we kind of find out, this is a world kind of similar to our own modern times, but the only oddity about this world is that there exists healer girls, or people that can heal with their song. And it's kind of a, what I kind of like about it is that it kind of makes it very grounded, that this is an actual profession in this world. You have to train for it. You have to get a license for it. There's clinics that people practice healing arts. There's even over-the-counter medicine in healer girl stuff, which is that you can buy records that have song in it, but it's kind of a generic healing. But it's definitely something that has to be crafted and trained, as Kana, Remy, and Hibiki are under the tutelage of Ria Karasuma, who works at this clinic, and they're all learning on a daily basis. Well, they're trying to learn on a daily basis. It doesn't seem like she wants to train them ever, even though they constantly want to. But they're constantly having to learn about medicine. They have to learn about, you know, your standard stuff that you would have to learn to become a practitioner of medicine. And so they have to learn about pharmaceuticals. They have to learn about different things about the human body. Because one kind of thing they really established really quickly is they're not allowed to perform their healing on people. They're not allowed to just run down and some kid skins his knee and do healing magic on them. They have to actually learn, because there's an actual craft to it itself, because they have to tailor make their music for their patient. If they don't do it properly, they can actually cause discomfort or uneasiness about their patient. So one really good example early on was they had this pregnant lady who was having retractions or contractions. And this other girl, who was a C rank, I believe she was, she starts to perform on her with Kana, and they mess up. They're like halfway through the song, and then suddenly things start crumbling. They kind of give you a visual, almost as if they're taking the person and bringing them into a windy field of grass. And then at some point, everything starts to crumble around them because they're not doing it properly. They're not tailoring it to both the pregnant mother and the infant inside of her. So it quickly falls apart. So that's something they have to really learn, is that they have to tailor every song for exactly what they're performing. And I like later on, they kind of start getting into actually performing music at like surgeries and stuff like that to calm the nerves of the patient, plus the one performing the surgery itself. But yeah, that's pretty much them learning their art and trying to learn something from this apprentice this teacher that doesn't want to teach them anything half the time. Your thoughts on Healer Girl?
I absolutely love this show. I love the music. I love the characters. I really, really enjoyed the visuals. This is one of those shows that I love how, like Andrew was talking about, the balancing between the different aspects. The surgeries were some of the most fantastic aspects of this show. Of like Andrew was talking about, the balancing between the surgeons and the surgery and the patient, and how just the minor things can start to spiral out of control very quickly. And when the teacher would jump in and get involved in the situation to kind of bring it back out of its kind of critical situation or something like that, all of these things place a weight on what's going on in these situations. And I really enjoy that aspect of it. Again, I really, really do love the visuals. When they were doing, like Andrew was talking about, the kind of visualization of these, the singing, and how all of these moments of kind of these, flying away into these, peaceful fields and these healing angels, or whatever you want to call them, these miniature versions of
Imagies.
Yeah, the miniature versions of all these characters as they're singing and holding these characters up and saying, look, it's going to be okay. We're going to make it through this. A lot of this stuff, I was teared up several times constantly with these goosebumps of just being swallowed up by these moments, and I really, really enjoyed it. So yeah, I highly recommend this, especially if you love musicals and stuff like that. A lot of the times it did get kind of cheesy with the musical aspect. I will not deny that.
Oh my gosh, an entire episode of them not stopping singing. I was like, that was super cheesy. I mean, it was goofy, but it was super cheesy.
But yeah.
Okay, please stop singing. Please stop singing everything.
Overall, I really enjoyed myself watching this show.
I started very hot on this show and had a very long lulling point of this show before it kind of finished. I think this is one of those shows where I love the concept behind it. I think it's an absolutely beautiful show. Studio 3 Hertz did a fantastic job with perspective shots, just animating the characters singing. Again, a lot of the performances when they're singing, music, absolutely top notch. They have like every time the characters sing, they're really ramping up the instrumentals. They have like this whole orchestra in the background. And the three seiyus or their vocalists just did a fantastic job of performing these songs, pretty much all in sync with each other. It just sounded so beautiful. Like, if you're going to have a show that's about girls healing with music, you kind of need to have really good music. So they pulled it off. Like, these girls did a fantastic job of performing their songs. And again, the instrumentals to back it up just made every single point they were actually singing just phenomenal. The problem that I had with the show is that I really loved how it opened up. I really love this idea of really solidifying that this is a profession. This is something that exists in our modern times. This is something that can go side and side. They kind of play a little joke on the idea. They kind of almost pegged it into the realm of something like a chiropractor, where like the hospitals and stuff don't really acknowledge them as being actual, you know, professionals, and they kind of look down upon them a little bit. But then you kind of have them actually come into an actual real-world environment of, like, again, a surgery or something like that, where they almost kind of have to acknowledge them. Like, okay, these people did kind of help us get through this whole project because, again, they don't want to see them as being equals or at least, you know, coincide with them. But at the end, they realize, no, these are actually beneficial assets to our practice. And I think that's a nice thing because early on, the big question mark is, so can they sing and close a, like, some, if somebody's stabbed or something like that, can they just like sing and it just closes up? It still paints it as they still have to technically have surgeons. They have to have hospitals. They can't, it's not a cure all, and there's limits to what they can do. A lot of it, again, is kind of soothing pain. It's soothing and it's helping with certain illnesses and stuff like that. It's not a cure all. And so they kind of work side by side. And I really love how they established it as an actual real-world environment working profession. This is our modern time wizards. And the way that they managed to make that work and feel grounded in reality was really cool. I really liked it. It felt believable to have this as an existence in this world. And then, like I said, it kind of lulled for me. The music and the performances were still fantastic, but it just kind of... It got to a point where it just kind of lulled. I still love the music, but they were getting into like the, you know, the school festivals, and they were doing the typical anime trope type of stuff, throwing it in there out of nowhere. And it's like, get back to over here where it was really interesting, and it felt like a real profession. Why are we doing all this stuff and just kind of messing around? And then it felt like at the very end of it, it kind of felt rushed. So it was like, why did we spend all this time with the festival and stuff like this, and now we're rushing to this kind of... They kind of, since it's an original, they kind of did like an almost an after story kind of thing. Like, this is where they're going. Like, this is the direction they're taking these characters. And I felt like that part felt very rushed because, again, I feel like they wasted too much time over here. The stuff that wasn't so interesting to me. Now, it could be a lot of, obviously for Chris, other people could be a lot more interesting. But I felt like it was kind of a waste of time because, and why I say that is because I wasn't as interested in all that kind of fluff that they put in the middle there. What I was drawn to was, again, the music. What I was drawn to was the characters and them growing in this profession. It wasn't all this other stuff that kind of felt like it derailed the story and, again, kind of lost my interest. But in the end, it was still a very beautiful show. I still really enjoyed it. I think it was a fantastic and very different take on, again, like a, I don't know, magician healer type of story. But it's very unique in its own right. And I think the characters really... really carried the show a lot. Kana's kind of goofy, ganky, a little bit ganky and very ditzy in a lot of regards, really headstrong going into situations. Remy, I like what they did with Remy, especially with her story with her maid. I think it was super fantastic. At the same time, early on, she was really annoying. Like, her obsession with her master was like, okay, this is going to get annoying really quickly. And it kept doing it. I'm like, please stop. Just we get it. You're obsessed with your master. Please stop. Hibiki was kind of out of nowhere, it felt like. Like, because she was like the last, I think, yeah, she was the last one they really got into. And her kind of insecurities about her skills was a little bit heartbreaking. At the same time, didn't really feel like, I don't know, I feel like it didn't execute it quite right for me. But, I mean, it still kind of delivered the impact that it was going for. And I always liked her as a character, especially early on. I just got a huge kick out of the stupid face in the corner of her room.
I was actually surprised.
Out, and then later on she freaks out about it.
To be honest, I was actually very surprised how they didn't, like, because if you go into it at face value, Kana is obviously the one who's supposed to be the one that takes over and becomes the prodigy out of the three of them.
She had her image come out like right off the bat.
Right. And essentially they
seem to insinuate that the more skilled you are, the more capable you are of bringing out what they call an image, which is like, again, like Chris was mentioning, like these little chibi versions of you that come out, and it seems like they amplify what you're doing. And she showed that she's able to do that like really early on. So yeah, it kind of gives this idea that she's like a prodigy, like she's way too good for her own self.
Right. And so you would figure that the other two would kind of get put to the wayside pretty quickly and just become more focused on Kana. They didn't do that. Instead,
because she sucks at her grades.
Yeah,
she sucks at knowledge about pharmaceuticals and stuff.
And when it comes down to it, like Andrew was mentioning, the other two very quickly kind of get wrapped into the main as a trio. These three are fantastic together. Each one of them has their own strength that they bring to the team, and eventually they all at one point towards the end they're all going, no, I'm jealous of you, I'm jealous of you, I'm jealous of you, and how you can do this. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. So yeah, I like how they didn't just make one of them shine more than the other two is my point.
That's and Sonya was great too. I love when they first introduced Sonya.
She is great.
She comes to Kana and goes, I need you to come with me over here. And Kana's never met her before. She's like, okay. And then Sonya starts walking away. And then Kana just starts bolting the other direction. And then she chases her down and says, why'd you run away? Well, my mom said never to go with strangers. She's like, that's really good advice, but I need you to come with me. It's like, lol. So dorky. They're a bunch of goofballs. Anyways, that's Healer Girl. Check that out. I was surprised. There's so many shows this season had rap battles. Like Kaguya had rap battles. Obviously, your boy Kongming had rap battles. Ahead-in-San had rap, I think, at some point. Healer Girl. Like I was waiting for it. Like, I was like, Remy gets a little bit like rock-ish, but yeah, that was the only one. Of course, they were trying to keep it strictly like.
Seemed like something else had rap as well.
Yeah, I think that was another one. It was a little like four or five shows. Like, what is with rap this season? Everybody wants to do rap this season. Anyways, Healer Girl, that's show. Moving on, we have I'm Quitting Heroing, or Yusha Yamimasu. This one's streaming on High Dive, ran for 12 episodes, done by EMT Squared. The source is a light novel. The genres are action, adventure, comedy, fantasy. And be advised, there's technically two OVAs. I think one's coming out August, I think. And I think one already came out. I haven't checked out yet. But, yeah. This one follows the hero of this fantasy world, Leo. As we kind of find out, this guy is super powerful, and he has gone out there and he has destroyed the Demon Lord and her entire army. And then upon returning back to the kingdom, you know, proud and having taken and saved humankind, they reject him. They're like, okay, the biggest threat's gone. This guy's obviously a monster because he was able to solo take down the entire Demon Lord army. This guy's very dangerous. We don't like him. We need to get him out of here. And even the king himself's like, you know, look, Leo, I know you did a lot of great things for us. You took down the Demon Lord. I'm really thankful, but I have to listen to the people. I have to exile you. I have to get you out of here. So Leo accepts this and leaves, and he goes back to the Demon Lord, walks into her throne room and says, hey, can I get a job here? can I help you rebuild the Demon Lord army? The humans don't want me. Might as well come here, kind of thing. Ekidona, the Demon Lord, is like, no, get the hell out of here. Tries to blast him. Of course, he doesn't hurt him because he's the super overpowered hero. So he decides to get the generals off the side, the four generals, and say, hey, look, guys, I really want to help you here. Can I prove myself to you? Well, I think it was Steina eventually says, you know, look, if you can prove to each one of us that you are going to help us, we will together, because they kind of have a feeling that, you know, he does want to help them. We'll go to the Demon Lord and try to convince her for you. And so that kind of starts this whole thing where Leo has to go to each one of these generals, help them with their jobs, help them make them more efficient, help them with their issues, and all to convince them that he does want to, in fact, help the Demon Lord. And then they can go tell the Demon Lord to help her out. So your thoughts on I'm Quitting Heroing? I really hate that synopsis because it's so much more than this. I'm probably going to get into it, but
One of the things that I do truly love about this is that they took something that at the very beginning seems kind of odd and you kind of want to dig into it. And they kind of full circled it. So that beginning was important and crucial at the end. And I think that this is one of the things that makes the show as unique as it is. Leo as a character is an oddity. You as you're watching through the entire story, you find that Leo is probably one of the more fascinating aspects to this story. Because every time he turns a page on another character in the story, you find yourself being more and more intrigued by Leo himself. For instance, he's at the very beginning, you're going into the aspect of Leo going into the Demon Lord's army and finding himself trying to get himself involved in this. And he goes through the process of quote unquote fixing each one of the Demon Lord's generals. And as each one of these characters, he's trying to fix them. He's effectively learning more about himself and at the same time opening more doors to who he is as a character. Ultimately, in the penultimate, getting to ultimately the Demon Lord herself. And this is one of the fascinating aspects to this show, is that each chapter is introducing you more to not only those characters but also to him. And I really do love the character development in general in this show. It's, to me, it's really well done, and it doesn't feel like it's leaving anything per se on the table. It's saying yes, all of these things are important ultimately. And I do give a lot of props to this. Is it one of my favorites of all time? No, but it is a very good one for sure.
Yeah, I this is a troubling one, because I think overall, like, the first 11 episodes of this show was absolutely incredible. And it's funny, because coming into the show is not really, it's not like super hyper engaging. Like, opening up the show, it's like, okay, betrayed hero is betraying the people because, well, they kicked me out. I might as well join the bad guys. They might accept me. And yeah, like, to Chris's credit, I do agree the idea that it's one of those things where over time you do figure out why. Like, this isn't, like I kind of mentioned in a video that I made, really kind of hyping up the show about halfway through, is like, this is the ultimate example of a show that's about the title, but the title means so much more. Like, yes, he's quitting heroing as the idea that he's no longer the hero. I'm quitting heroing. Ha ha ha. Go join the evil Demon Lord's army. But then, like, it becomes like the title becomes the hero itself. Like, it becomes the character himself, Leo. And when you start to really dive in, starting off, it like feels like that. It feels like it's just, okay, hero leaves, joins the Demon Lord army, gets harem. He's going to get Echidona, and Lily's cute, and then you also have Steina, and then Edwald's got a cute daughter. He's going to get a harem, right? No, it's not about that. It's like, it's about helping each one of these generals, and that was fun. I mean, it technically has like an episode per general as they go through each one of them, and then it hits one particular general, and the door just flings right open, and I'm like, holy crap, what are they doing with Leo as a character? Like, it suddenly out of nowhere shifts, and I'm going, oh my gosh, if they're doing this is crazy. Like, it just it's kind of like the punchline issue. Like, we tell people all the time, punchline's fantastic. It's like, well, it's just an ecchi show. Yeah, but just keep watching it. Like, it opens up as an ecchi show, and it's dumb ecchi. And at some point, four or five of six episodes in, it just flips it. And you're like, what is a show anymore? Like, what are we doing? And it's so fantastic how it flips it. This show does the same thing. At some point, it just flips it. The script just gets flipped, and suddenly it's like, what am I watching now? Like, this is not what I came into the show expecting, and now suddenly I'm realizing this writer is really good at what they do, and they're really good at really taking a hero character, an overpowered main character, and really tearing him apart and doing something really incredible with it. And that's what really hooked me. Like, I'm suddenly going, this is easily going to be the greatest show of the season, possibly of the year. And I loved every minute of it, building up all the way up. So much tension they're building up with this character and doing, again, they're essentially taking the concept of a hero and really dissecting it and making it into a mindset that is kind of toxic in itself. And then, like I said, it builds up and it builds up and it builds up. And people disagree with me. That's perfectly fine. I feel like as much as I loved that build up so much, every minute of it I loved and I was eating it up. I do feel like that last episode, 12, just it's a good ending, but it just doesn't deliver on the build up of an impact that it was trying to build up. Like everything was building up to something really explosive. And I felt like it just petered out. Like that last moment, it's fine. It's just it didn't hit. Not that I wanted it to do one thing or another, and people know what I'm talking about. They had two choices. It just it didn't deliver an impact. And it almost felt like it ignores everything that built up to that point. There was a cause and effect, and they didn't even acknowledge the cause itself. It did not have the impact at the end that I was really expecting to happen, especially since I know this writer's so dang good at what they do. They do characters so dang good. I loved every single minute of the show, more so in the middle half, the middle section and towards the later part, but I think it failed to deliver an impactful ending that really gave that oomph for all that buildup. And that's my only dissatisfaction with the show. Other than that, I still think it's an incredible journey, and I really love what they did with Leo as a character, and it's some of the best overpowered main character writing I've ever seen. Really not making it about the overpoweredness, but really about the effects of it having on somebody. And again, really what your whole purpose was, again, to be a hero, and what does it mean to be kind of dislodged from that, and the effects it has on a character. There's one really, it's not a spoiler, but there's one really good line at some point, or at least segment of lines, where it really kind of hits on this idea of, why are you not angry? Why don't you just go kill them? Like, you can easily take out all the humans. Why wouldn't you? Like, it's coming from a character that literally hates humans. And he's like, when they said that, I was happy. Like, it's this moment of, like, when they said they no longer wanted me, I was happy. I was free. And it was like, it felt so weird how they laid it out. And I like that I felt weird at that time. I felt uneasy when those lines came out, because it ends up getting into something later on that kind of solidifies why that would feel so uneasy. Why is he smiling when he says that? It's such good character writing. And again, aside from my dislike of the impact of the final episode, again, some people disagree. It was still a really great journey.
I am very curious if they anime original the end.
That it went away from it.
Really?
So.
I'm very curious, because I do kind of agree that it didn't have the impact that I was kind of hoping for. I don't think it was bad in any way. I very much came away from this feeling complete in my journey. But when it comes down to it, I'm not going to deny it didn't hit as much as I wanted it to.
Yeah. Like I said, there was two routes, and it's not that I wanted one or the other. It's just it didn't feel like oomph. Like, it didn't feel like all that buildup was for something. Anyways, I'm quitting heroing. Definitely a suggestion in the end. I really enjoyed it. So, Tomodachi Game is our next one, streaming on Crunchyroll. We're for 12 episodes, done by Studio Okuroto Naburo. And this one is sources of manga. The genres are drama, mystery, psychological. And this one follows Yuichi, Shiho, Makoto, Yutoroi, and Tenji. And they are five friends. I can never say it right, whenever I say it. They're five friends. They're friends. They're in the same class together, and they're friends. And at some point, the class is kind of gathering funds to go on this big field trip, and Yuichi's, like, the poorest, so he has to go out and do, like, a bunch of work by himself to get all the money for it, and he pulls it off. Everybody's got the money, everybody's happy, and then the money goes missing, and everybody's trying to suspect people, and then eventually two of the classmates, the class prez and the vice prez, they disappear. Everybody's suspecting them. And then at some point, everybody seems to get a letter sent to them to all meet each other at the school gates. And when they arrive there, everybody's like, hey, you sent me a letter. What'd you need? No, you sent me a letter. Then they get attacked by some people and dragged off to what is called the Tomodachi game, where they're all in like this facility and they have to compete, prove that they're friends, basically. They claim specifically, if you're not true friends, if you don't trust your friends, you will fail this game. And it's just basically them going through game after game that really challenge their trust of each other and if they're really friends, all for the sake of debt. So they start off with this mindset that they all have this kind of combined debt that they assume somebody has to, you know, at least authorize them to join the game. So one of the five friends obviously pulled them all into this. So they have a debt. Were they the ones that stole the money? Well, that's all kind of under question as they go through each of these games. Depending on what you do in each game could get you more debt. Revealing how much debt you have at the current time on your little score on your name tag could get you more debt. It's all to kind of compete against this game. Yuichi's mostly the perspective that we get. Yuichi, again, like I said earlier, is like the kid that's kind of having to strive to survive. He doesn't have much money. He's of two minds. I think they said at some point it was his mom and dad. I don't think they really specified, but
his mom wants him to be friends with people and his dad wants him to care about money.
Yeah, his mom kind of instills upon him that friendship's the most important thing in life, and his father is money is the most important things in life, which kind of indicates these two probably went to the Tomodachi game at some point, because why would they bring that up? Because it's specifically, very specific to the Tomodachi game that he's now involved with. But Yuichi is kind of clever in the idea that he's very tricky. He knows how to really manipulate people, and so he kind of becomes a focal point of really trying to, you know, kind of navigate everything, the situation. Obviously, the friends, you know, having their own possible gain in the whole situation. But Yuichi's goal really turns into quickly to just, I want to destroy the Tomodachi game. And he won't let them defeat him, and he's going to destroy them. So, your thoughts on Bob the Builder and Chucky having a baby called Manabu-kun?
When it comes down to it, I, for the longest time, I have watched through all the entire show, and I tried really, really hard to decide if I liked the show or hated it, because I couldn't decide. Because in one hand, I kind of liked the concept, and in the other hand, I just despised the characters. In general, I despise the characters.
There's no good characters.
And this is really the frustrating aspect of, because everybody wants to pretend like they're the master evil mind behind everything.
Everything's according to Gagaku, Chris.
I know, and this is the annoying thing is I can't empathize with any of these characters. Their emotions are so extreme in every situation. It's frustrating because Yuichi, I can't understand him in any way, shape, or form. Shiho, I guess, kind of. Tenji, maybe. I didn't care for it. And I guess that makes sense that all these characters are, effectively extreme versions of each one of these emotions, I guess. I got frustrated. And in the end, I got so annoyed by all these characters that I couldn't...
I couldn't enjoy it. A very abrupt ending.
It was. And that's the frustrating thing is I kind of wanted to like it, but I don't. And I know that I'm making all kinds of people mad because I didn't understand it something or other, I'm sure. But when it comes down to it, I wish I liked it. But when it comes down to it, and I did watch and wanted to enjoy it, but I couldn't, I just really couldn't. So I'll leave it there.
Chris uneasily bashes a show, and he doesn't. Yeah, you guys know why he doesn't bash shows. He just gets like so uneasy about it. No, this is definitely all according to plan. The anime, and there's a side of me that kind of likes it sometimes, but for the most part, I don't. And I think that's really the driving force for somebody going to enjoy this show. And that's where most of the comments that I've seen is most people that like this show like Tenji or Yuichi. No, like Tenji. Nobody likes Tenji. Most people that like this show like Yuichi. They like a main character that doesn't whine and sit around. And when he does whine, you know he's just doing it because it's part of the plan. Yuichi is a male protagonist character that's not an absolute spaz that sits there and whines. And a lot of people do like that aspect. I mean, that's kind of similar to something like Death Note and stuff. It's a main character that's not a side character. He's not a doormat for everybody else. He really does take charge and just drives into something. And if you like that type of main character, and again, technically the type that goes, haha, it's all according to my plan in the end, every single time, you're going to enjoy it. And even when you think that it might be somebody else's plan, it's probably Yuichi's plan. He's that smart and he's that calculative. And I think if you like that kind of style, especially in the realm of a quote unquote death game, and yes, it's a death game, whether you like it or not, it's a death game because debt is death. And if you like that in that kind of setting, I think it's going to even be more of a drive for people to check it out. Me personally, I'm kind of shrug on it. And it's honestly, I get most of the time, I get really frustrated with it's all according to plan writing. I had that same problem with Platinum Inn. It's like every time it would be all according to this guy's plan, it's just like, okay, then why am I even watching? Like everything is according to your plan. And if you don't make it interesting enough to, if you don't make it twist when it happens, I don't care. I don't care for you to reveal to me everything you've laid out after the fact and go, oh, I tricked you. Like, okay, next time something happens, again, next time Yuichi cries, I'm going to go, it's just according to his plan. Why are you acting like it's a big deal?
In a lot of cases, that's it. And that was the thing that frustrated me is if
he actually failed here and there, I would probably be more interested. And I don't think he really does that.
Exactly. It was, he's really a demon in disguise. No, okay, yeah, but he's practically pulling these things out of his hind end. I mean, I would believe it if I could go through the process of the, but no, it doesn't. It just, I'm going to honey trap him. Okay, I gotcha. I understand the honey trap thing, but when it comes down to it, really? I mean, come on, guys.
No, I agree with Chris that I think the biggest flaw this show has, I mean, besides, I think if you like Yuichi's character from the first episode, you're going to love the show. But I think the biggest issue this show really had was that it never established them as friends. Like, from the get-go, it feels like these guys are just at each other's throats. It's like, wait, so am I supposed to believe these are friends? Like, when do these people meet? Like, have they ever... Like, this is supposed to be the ultimate game for friends, and it's like, I don't really feel like these guys are friends. But again, my expectation was that it was going to be friendships through tribulations. Like, they're going to be put through some crazy stuff. They're going to reveal all their cards. They're going to show how they really feel about each other, and that's going to make them even stronger friends. And I think if that's the ultimate goal of the manga, because obviously this keeps going, I think that will actually be really cool. That we would, as the viewer and as the reader, would learn more about these guys and have them become solidified as friends through the Tomodachi game. Because it's obviously, whoever's pulling the strings in the background for this Tomodachi game has a lot of power, and they're controlling a lot of organizations, including the police. So they can pretty much do whatever they want, and these kids are going to get dragged through it. And it gets deeper and deeper as it goes along, and much more threatening as it goes along, that it could turn into something really good. I just think that for this first kind of segment, we haven't really gotten there with maybe with one character. Other than that, I think everybody else is kind of, a little bit unlikable. There's no likable characters here. Everybody is a facade of what they actually are, and for some reason, everybody's a mastermind in their own mind about how they're going to manipulate everybody else, even though they just joined this Tomodachi game. And just had me the entire time expecting Yutori to be the one that's behind everything. She's behind everything. You know she's going to be behind everything. In the end, Yutori is going to be behind everything, because she's the only character that never, like, shows a derpy evil face, and she's the only one in the OPED that doesn't have an evil face. So you know she's a mastermind.
Something fun to consider that you'll probably, depending on if you feel like it's spoilery, you can yank it, but the group that kidnapped a certain character towards the end, is pretending to be involved in the Tamodachi game, but Tamodachi game is a shadowy organization that nobody knows about.
Right.
That was stupid.
All right, they were doing their own Tamodachi game, which they're not. They don't like that.
Right.
It's just really making the Tamodachi game to be out like a, yes, it's a single, it's kind of like if somebody goes around acting like they're the Yakuza are going to be really angry about that.
Right. I agree. But nobody knows about this, and you're not supposed to talk to anybody about this organization that supposedly doesn't exist, but random gangsters on the middle of the street know about it.
Well, they could have been involved in a game. They could have been in a game. But yeah, that's Tamodachi game. Check that out if that sounds good to you. It was a good ride, though. In the end, it was fine. I just feel like the ending for sure is like super like, all right, to the next game. Bye, everybody. It's like, okay. That wasn't really satisfying ending at all. But yeah, check that out if that's interesting to you. The Greatest Demon Lord is reborn as a typical nobody, the most misleading title ever. Shijo Saikyo no Daimao Murabito ni Tensei Suru. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, ran for 12 episodes, done by Studio Silverlink and Blade. The source is a light novel. The genres are action and fantasy. This one follows Ard, and it follows the demon lord of this world, and he's super powerful, and he leads this entire demon lord army. And at some point, it kind of shows how he's feeling secluded, like nobody sees him as human anymore. They don't, you know, he's not seen as a regular everybody. Like he's secluded to being royalty, basically, and so he feels very isolated. And at some point, kind of feeling like he's lonely, he doesn't like this anymore, he decides to cast a spell to reborn himself. So he pretty much gets rid of himself and allows himself to be reborn in the future. And he wants to be reborn as a typical nobody, but yeah, it just so happens he is born under the like these two heroes, like this mother and father that used to be like these big special heroes and adventurers. So yeah, that didn't work out. But of course, he still has a lot of his power. He has his knowledge from his previous life. And it's kind of similar to the Demon Lord Academy, where it's like this idea that everything has been dumbed down. Like magic's been really dumbed down. Human and magic kind has been kind of dumbed down to the point where everybody's forgotten these old. Like he uses abilities and everybody's like, oh, that's a secret lost magic art or something like that, and he's like, oh, that's just flight or something like that. So obviously he's got to edge up to everything else because he knows about all this lost magic art. But yeah, quickly wants to meet friends, but he's terrible at it because he's always been isolated as the demon lord for so long that he doesn't know how to meet people. He's always like expecting people to come to him to seek an audience. So him trying to meet people is really terrible. Eventually, knowing that his parents knew the mayor of the town, Weiss, figures, you know, I should be able to be friends with his daughter, Irina. So he quickly gravitates to her and tries to be friends with her, but she doesn't really like her existence. She feels like she's been bullied out of, she doesn't feel like she can meet anybody and that she's always bullied out of friends and stuff. Eventually he ends up going to this academy together with her and meets Ginny, who's this like succubus servant girl that gets beat around and teaches them how to use magic, and yeah, tries to hide the fact that he was past demon lord because, oh, it just so happens one of his old generals works as a teacher here. And then it gets crazier later on. Weird stuff later on. But yeah, your thoughts.
Do you need to ask when you talked about the it gets weird later on? That probably is what destroyed it for me. I don't know. I was
very mixed with the later part.
I was okay with it per se. It was doing fine. It just kind of a silly kind of build your harem. Kind of feels like it wants to have fun and have at the same time, you know, kind of a semi-serious storyline. And I thought it was doing fine. And then time. And not, I kind of like that they got into some of the background story through this thing that they were doing towards the end. But at the same time, it really got frustrating, especially when they introduced the antagonist of the quote unquote time leap that they were doing. And I got really, really frustrated in that. And I, it maybe that's what kind of checked me out, because I don't think
it was fine. It was just kind of boring.
To me, it didn't work, and I got really kind of frustrated with it, and it didn't add anything to the story as a whole. Like I said, I did like the fact that they kind of were introducing some of the characters that they kept talking about, and getting into those characters was fine. But when it comes down to it, I was more frustrated by it didn't feel like it was doing anything except for arguing about an ultimate consequence. And it got really frustrating to me. And I kind of ended up more on the I didn't much care for it in the end.
I enjoy any scene with Guinea in it. That's it.
No, I like Sylphie too.
Sylphie was great too. When they finally introduced Sylphie, that was funny because she keeps getting tripped up by Inina, because she sees somebody else in Inina. So every time Inina says something like, you know, bad or something like that, she suddenly just cripples. So that was super cute. I this is kind of one of those shows where it kind of opens up. Ard's kind of unbearable. Like he's stupid, unable to socialize with people. Like he's super bad at socializing. And again, obviously, according to the story, is because he was a demon lord for so long that he forgot how to socialize with normal people because everybody did not want to socialize with him normally. So he's super stupid at the very beginning. And I appreciate the fact that at some point they kind of time jump and get away from that. Like he does learn how to communicate with people. Although he does kind of see things differently than most people still, even at that point, he at least can talk to people. And I liked him pulling in Guinea, and it was feeling like it was going to be just a standard overpowered main character reborn, which is kind of with isekai is kind of the booming trend right now is the reborn self. You know, strongest stage with the weakest crest, and the Demon Lord Academy one. It seems like that's like the new trend right now, along with isekais, is not to be transported into another world, but just to be reborn in the same world, but a little bit more powerful. And it felt like I was going to go in the standard fare with that, with a little harem. And I got a kick out of Inanna. I really liked Guinea. I think Guinea is just super forward. Like at the very beginning, Guinea is like super timid because again, she's technically bossed around by this Raido guy that was her master. You know, my heart broke for her. And then Ard gives him like, or kind of guides her into how to use magic in a certain way that kind of benefits her. And then she gets like this massive amount of confidence, and technically she's a succubus. And so she goes like all the harem-y types moments of the show were like completely driven by her. Like her idea for a maid cafe at the school was like, yes, can we have that? And it almost seemed like they were going to do it, but then they don't. Yeah, her ideas for the outfits, so I was like, okay, yeah, we'll go with this.
Guinea just works on getting Irina to accept a harem for him.
Yeah, every time Guinea's talking about, like, we need to get, like, five more people for his harem, and Irina's like, no, I don't accept this idea of a harem. It's only me. It was a lot of fun. I just like the goofy shenanigans harem moments. Like, everything else outside of that was just, I don't know, it just wasn't that interesting. Like, it never got, I think the only part where that was outside of the harem shenanigans stuff that I was like, okay, that came out of nowhere was Rado. Like, out of nowhere, they're trying to do something with him, and it kind of feels a little bit bad. And then it goes back to, like Chris said, just the whole later arc that it did nothing for me. It did nothing for me besides every now and then Guinea showing up and doing something pervy. Yeah, it was fine. Just not very interesting at the same time. This is very shrug show. It's not bad. It's there. And I think if you like the girls in the show, you might enjoy a little more. But it didn't really do anything too interesting in the end. Had a couple of laugh out loud moments, mainly around Sylphie and just shenanigans around Guinea. But other than that, it was trying to do something interesting, but it never really did anything interesting. And no real threats around him is going to be a threat because he's super overpowered. But yeah, it's just there. The greatest demon lord reborn is typical nobody as a typical harem show. That sounds good. Definitely check that out. This was like easily the most obvious thing to ever happen. I was like, yeah, this character's not just a normal maid.
Oh, yeah.
Moving on, Daemon. This one's streaming on Crunchyroll, run for 12 episodes, done by Studio Encouragement Films. The source is a manga. The genres are slice of life. And this one follows a guy named Nagamo. And Nagamo, at some point, he's in Tokyo trying to, you know, live his life as a musician. And at some point, he gets a letter from his mother saying, your father back at home is the hospital or something like that. So he quickly kind of drops his life and says, I need to go back home. Tells his current wife, or not current wife, his current girlfriend at the time, you know, look, I got to go back home and take care of the sweet shop that my father's running, and rushes back home. And when he gets there, which I think it was Kyoto, he rushes back home, and when he arrives there, come to find out, I think his dad just had hemorrhoids or something like that. It was like nothing bad. But now that he's there, he's like, you know, it kind of, the letter that he received from his mother, even though it was kind of an overblown, it kind of made him realize the idea of mortality. Like, you know, father's not going to always be around, and he really does love sweets. Like, Nagamo is like, he really loves sweets.
He really loves them sweets.
Like, the joke early on is this idea that they can't have him at the front of the store because he cries when he sells stuff. Like, he's sad to see them leave, the sweets. Like, he's that passionate about food. But, he really wants to take over the shop. But the problem is that his dad's already chosen somebody to take over the family business, and that is Itsuka, this girl that was abandoned by her father at the sweet shop. And so there's a little bit of a conflict there as Itsuka arriving there. She, being abandoned, feels like she really needs to try hard to not be kind of a dead weight in that place. So she tries really hard to, even though she's going to school too, tries really hard to, you know, manage the place, and she does, you know, desire to be that useful, that she could take over the business. But now Nagamo, who she feels abandoned the place, comes back. She's a little bit, you know, a little bit snarky to him, so he's got to kind of gain her favor at the same time, you know, kind of prove himself, but not really. He's just kind of a doofball. But I think the more interesting thing also story-wise is that at some point you kind of realize that Nagamo didn't really abandon the place. It was just that he overheard his grandfather say that it's not a good fit for him, and that he should, you know, go do his own thing, which he kind of obviously took very wrong, that he wasn't fit. Like, his grandfather didn't want him to be the person to take over the business, to do something else. That's why he chose to become a musician and leave, is that he felt like his grandfather did not want him to do that. So I'm glad they cleared that up really quickly, because it felt like that would be a really nasty kind of miscommunication thing to kind of drag out. But your thoughts on Daemon?
I very much enjoyed the show. It's got a soft, tender touch to a lot of the things that are going on. A lot of the emotions that are involved in a lot of these stories and that intertwine as the main storyline goes along, which is basically a coming of age for Itsuka. It's a injury and harm and how you heal from those past wounds and how family can lift you up in a lot of cases. I think that a lot of this was fantastically, the story was fantastically told all through this show. And I very much enjoyed it. The artwork was amazing. The voice acting was amazing. The character stories were amazing. I very much enjoyed myself watching this show.
Itsuka's voice was super cute.
I did. Super I agree. Cute. I
she think pulled she... that off so well. Of course, they had like a dialect there. Mm-hmm. It's very heavy. I'm glad the subtitlers decided not to make everything have a stupid southern twang like they always do with the subtitling for dialects. I really hate that, but they did it here and there, and I think they started building up later on, but still, I really do love this show. It's very, very laid back, wholesome. And what's interesting is when we first seen the synopsis for this, the thing at some point that happens is Nagumo, his mother out of nowhere says, look, Itsuka's father abandoned her, we don't know where her mother is at, you should be her father figure. And Nagumo doesn't really, like, he doesn't go, oh yeah, sure, I'll do that. it never really paints it, because the initial, when we seen the synopsis, was like, oh, this is going to be another bunny drop. We're going to have a bunny drop show where the very young girl is abandoned and this guy steps in and takes care of her and becomes a parental figure. Never really does that. I mean, he's just kind of there and supports her. I think it really early on, like their first encounter together, he just kind of like, I don't want to become her father, but I will always be there for her. Like, he wants to be that, some sort of figure, some sort of rock for her to stand on. And I do like that. I like that it didn't kind of take the obvious turn, but rather just kind of be very subtle about it. This is a, surprisingly, it has emotional points throughout this show. Don't get me wrong. But it's always kind of surrounding wholesomeness. Everything's kind of very wholesome. It's very subtle stuff. A lot of the stories are getting into is not high drama. Now, granted, you can argue that that's just kind of very light writing. So if you're expecting like huge plot points for characters with like heavy storylines that are going to get into some deep psychological stuff, don't really come into the show expecting that. Expect to kind of come into these very, again, wholesome stories, very subtle stories that, yes, technically affect people's lives, but at the same time, it's not going to get melodramatic. And I, obviously, anybody who listened to me long enough knows that I love when shows aren't melodramatic, because I hate melodrama. I mean, it's literally the opposite to Tomodachi Game, where everybody's like, you know, at each other's throat and claiming that a murderer, because they shouldn't be around a murderer, but then the next minute go, oh, never mind, I actually really like you. That's not this show. This is like complete opposite. This is just very subtle, very heartwarming. I think like the best example I can give for anybody that watched Flying Witch, it feels very like that, very just laid back, relax, enjoy your time. Every now and then have these little heartwarming moments where, yes, this daughter thinks that her mom's always making fun of her, and then realizing, no, she actually likes that about you. She likes this, the face that you give. It's just, it's super cute. There's so many cute little moments that just really warm your heart. I will say that like, early on, I had this expectation that it was going to be mainly about Nagumo and Itsuka and about their relationship. And then really quickly, they almost took a backseat to everybody else. Like, randomly, like, oh, there's this person over here. Let's start following their story. And it's like, wait, why are we going over here? Let's go back to Itsuka and Nagumo. And I think it's really because, again, that's not the focus, is their relationship, even though, yes, technically the overarching story is really the building of their relationship. But I feel like it was trying to take its time. Like, it's not trying to make it all about these two, but more so how they kind of grow closer due to these experiences with other people. And I think that was good in one sense, but kind of disappointing in another sense, because I would have loved more of their relationship building. But I think it was more natural this way.
I was trying to explain, when I said that this is a healing show, I was trying to give an idea of how this show feels. It's not a Yashike. It is a show about healing in a lot of ways. And I think it's very gentle in its storytelling and its healing aspects that are involved in these stories. Each story being something that is kind of it's a character drama moment, but it's not a, like Andrew said, it's not melodrama. It's something that is important to
it's
this
not
particular
life or death.
Yeah. It's something that's important to this one particular character or that particular character, but at the same time, it's not something that's monumental, you know, state secret type thing. It's something that's important to that character, and it's very gentle in the way that it handles that particular story.
Yeah, it sucks to say, because I know that there's a lot of people out there that they like simplicity, and I think there's other people out there that don't like simplicity. Like, unless there's something really grabbing them, they're going to be upset about it, and they're going to feel let down. So I think I'm just trying to gauge that difference there, is to not expect crazy drama points, to expect that these are – it's a simpler life, simpler – it's technically a simpler town. Like, he's going from, like, big city back to his hometown. Things are a lot more simpler there, and everybody's a lot more laid back, and so things are a lot more chill, and I think it's kind of portrays that very well. A lot of the characters are kind of just trying to chill and relax.
For instance, Nagumo loses his chestnut headpiece,
He's just a dork. Neither one of us has talked about this. I kind of said it at some point, but let's address the fact that Nagumo is a dork. He's an absolute dork. And I think that's what's so lovable about him. And I think that's what eventually kind of breaks Itsuka in the end. It's like, this guy's a dork. This guy's a baka.
Hey, and he loses his chestnut headpiece. And it's important to him. And when it comes down to it, it's not like
this comes down to like a district search party going on.
Yeah, it does have a heartwarming story behind why he likes the chestnuts. But when it comes down to it, like Andrew said, he's a dork, and the chestnut is important to him. And it's things like that that is gentle in its way, its storytelling, and that's an excellent example of. Not everything is like that. There's other things that are kind of drama points. This is just a good example of why it's important to him. Not everybody else will see it the same way. And Itsuka just so happens to be the one that solves that problem for him. And it was very sweet in the way it does that. And I loved it.
I did like the fact that Itsuka, especially early on, it really does feel like they were going to go in a route with her in the idea of, you know, this is technically a kid. This is a child. And yet she feels like the necessity to not be a burden. So she overworks herself and she doesn't really get to enjoy her childhood. I really thought they were going to get more into that. But I think it's kind of one of those aspects similar to Kisachi's story and the idea that she's over serious about what she's doing. And then I think everybody around them kind of have to make them realize, you know, just chill, relax. That's not what this is about. Like, relax and just enjoy what you're doing. And I think that's kind of a reminder to them and technically those around them that it's, again, simpler life, simpler times, relax kind of thing. Which, again, is to the credit of what they're going for here, which, again, is more wholesome and relaxation, which I think it really pulled it off, despite Nagumo being an absolute dork. Did I mention that he's a dork? He's a dork. It's a lovable dork. We like him. And Itsuka eventually realizes.
Yeah, even the one who fights it the hardest is the one that.
I think that's what she needed. I think that's what she needed because everybody else around her is either super serious about their work or, you know, dedicated to that work. And again, I think she kind of doesn't really outright say it, but Itsuka really does, you know, copy that in that she works really hard and doesn't enjoy life. And I think Nagumo coming back kind of re-interjects that into her that she should enjoy life.
Exactly. They both in a strange way, they both needed each other. Itsuka gave him the motivation to be more serious and Nagumo gave her the motivation to let go and enjoy life. And so I think both of them were absolutely crucial for each other.
There you go. That's Day I Am On. Definitely check that out. I would love another season.
Absolutely.
Felt very good. At the end, but would love more. So, last one we have is RPG Real Estate. This one is RPG Furusan. This one is streaming on Crunchyroll for 12 episodes, done by Studio Dogokobo. The source is a manga, and the genres are comedy, fantasy. And this one takes place in a fantasy setting, like you'd believe. The Demon Lord was defeated, and everybody still has to live on. So, one thing that most people need, obviously, is a place to stay. Whereas, you know, most adventurers go to inns and stuff. Most people actually need to settle down, so there needs to be a real estate company that will actually accommodate those folks. And so we follow one such place. We have Rufuria, Rakira, and Fa work at this one real estate place. And this girl named Katone is now moving to this town and is actually getting a job to work at this place. Well, first, she walks in and they think that she's looking for a place, so they help her find a place. And then she goes, oh yeah, by the way, I'm also working here. So she kind of learns the ropes from everybody and helps different creatures, people, adventurers, such and such, find places to live. Including even the place where the Demon Lord's like headquarters was at. They actually turn into amusement park and places to stay, which is interesting. But your thoughts? It got real dark, Chris.
Yes,
are you gonna bash the show because it got super dark?
No, not really.
Nobody believed it. Come on.
It didn't. I don't know. I did enjoy this show, especially the first eight. When it comes down to it, I made the joke about how I was hoping that this would do better than Dragon Goes House Hunting. And in a lot of ways, it did do better. But when it comes down to it, it still had what seems like the same issue in a weird way, where it's trying to play on the RPG tropes, but it kind of moved away from that kind of quicker than The Dragon Goes House Hunting. The Dragon Goes House Hunting really got... It was almost like it kept doubling down on it. We're going to keep going on this. We're going to do this. We're going to make it happen. And this one was like, yeah, that's what we're doing, but let's do it from this angle, or let's do it from this angle. It didn't really double down on it so much as it just went, oh, yeah? Well, and I think that Andrew had it nailed on the head when he said, is the order a rabbit in RPG real estate side? It really was. It was the girl, cute girls doing cute things, and it just so happens to be a real estate for fantasy setting. And that's really what it ended up being. And in a lot of cases, that's what I really enjoyed about it, until it got dark. And then I went, I'm never watching this show ever again. No, it did fine. When it started going to the dark side, it was okay. I see what you're doing. Okay, it just
technically
was
the OP kind of flags it.
Yeah,
the OP has like cute little fa covered in blood. It's like, what are we doing?
Yeah, it really kind of made the world story. It dragged the world story and explained one of the question characters, and it kind of dug into that, and that's really what they were kind of going for, and I see what they were doing. So do I want to see more? Yeah, I would love to see it if they can kind of stay on the more lighter side and just have that as the darkest that they ever go, because I really don't want to see these girls cry. So yeah,
I don't really have too much to say on the show. I think the joke is there that it's pretty much very feely like Is the Order a Rabbit early on, but instead of pouring tea and stuff, they're taking people out to places to look at. And yeah, I think I agree with Chris in that it's pretty much hitting on all the RPG tropes as usual. You know, you can go live here for really cheap, but you have to be okay with adventurers coming in and tearing through all your stuff. Yes, we got that joke. It kind of does all those and kind of gets through all of them. And I think at some point it kind of just starts to do its own thing, where it goes, okay, well, let's just have, you know, different personal stories of different people that are looking for specific places. And that's our whole point. They have to figure out what makes their client tick and really find a place that fits them. So, yeah. I need a place to live with my huge, gigantic, flying unicorn thing. Well, everything's super expensive that has space for that thing in town, so we have to figure something out that works for them. Okay, so obviously this right here makes perfect sense. Let's do this instead. That's kind of what it's going for, and it's just very shrug stories for me. Most of the time, it's just really kind of my driving force was just cute girls doing cute things, plus ecchi. This isn't like Is the Order a Rabbit, where it's very tame, cutesy girls. This is kind of Is the Order a Rabbit. Yes, technically Is the Order a Rabbit had characters and undies every now and then, but this one kind of just goes a little bit further. Every episode has to have some like super... We know what they're doing here. We know exactly what they're selling right here. It gets risky and ecchi a lot. So if you're looking for something that's more in that risky area with cute girls doing cute things, this is what it kind of delivers. Other than that, those moments are about the only thing that was really entertaining about the show, because everything outside of that was just very, very basic stuff here. I did enjoy getting a little more into the characters. Obviously, Rufuria is like super selfish. And then later on, you realize, oh, she doesn't want to just ditch, because it always seems like she wants to find any opportunity to move up in the chain and ditch the real estate place. But then you kind of find out what's her driving force, and it's like, oh, okay, cute. That's all. She could have said that earlier. Rocky Dodge is literally the warrior reject. There's no more war, and she's a family of warriors, so what is she going to do kind of thing. Fa is just adorable. Fa is just super adorable, runs around being Fa. And I think Katone was a great main character. She's not really – it doesn't seem like she's just, like, super caring, and that's really her driving force. And I – it's endearing. It's something that you enjoy watching. So, solid cast. I think the biggest upset I think I had with the show was that it just didn't look good. It didn't look good at all. This is very disappointing for Dogokubo. I kind of mentioned that before with what was the other show that they messed up with? The Childhood Friend Won't Lose. Dogokubo did that one, and it was like super rough looking, and I felt like this was the same team. Like Dogokubo's got an A team and a B team. This is the B team. It didn't look good. I joked early on when our first impressions, they had like this one scene where it seemed like Rakira's eyes were running away from her nose. It's just, I don't know. It's not terrible, but at the same time, it had some really rough shots. And that was a little bit disappointing because, as I always say, the best thing to have with the cute girls doing cute things is cute girls. And when their eyes are running away from their nose, they're not so cute. They're kind of cute, but they're not as cute as they could be. You're worried for them instead of going, oh, you're going, oh, don't do that. So, yeah, that's RPG Real Estate. Cute girls doing cute things with some a good focus on ecchi and shenanigans. And Foz is adorable.
Next season is in the island paradise.
Spoiler. Thanks, Chris.
Right.
Thanks for spoiling everything, Chris. Is there anything else you want to reveal about the whole show before?
Yeah, how about I reveal the secret of the song?
Who is Fa? Because we totally didn't see that coming. Anyways, that's it for our first part of our spring 2022 reviews. I don't know why I'm tripping up on that. So next week, we are expecting to do at least Spriggan, Skeleton Knight, Heroine Run the Show, Miss Shachiku, Day Day Live, Season 4. Love After World Domination, ?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's for sure. Chris is watching that show. I think Chris is the only person that loves that show. I know there's other people that do. Q?
Probably not.
I think we're both in the same boat. We really want to watch it, but we don't think it's going to happen. Spy Family. Can't say X. Don't Hurt Me, My Healer. Birdie Wing?
Absolutely.
There you go. Birdie Wing's coming. Kaginato Season 2. The Rising of the Shield Heroes second season. I guess we'll talk about that. Dawn of the Witch. Demon Girl Next Door. Kaguya-sama Love is War. Ultra Romantic. Koichi Tsubaki. I think he's trying to watch the Komi-san Can't Communicate, yeah. But I don't know when that's supposed to end.
I'm just over halfway through.
Is it supposed to end? I don't know. Nobody knows when it's ending. We'll see. And I think that's it. I guess Life Hack of Kawashiri. I don't know if one of us will watch that. Oh, Onipon as well.
If you're
going
to watch it,
Onipon's going another season. That's right. So
if you're going to watch it, watch it. Otherwise, just say no.
You sneeze and it finishes. I don't know. It's literally going to take 2 seconds to watch that show. Yeah, Onipon, Awashi, a couple cuckoos, and Summertime Rending will go another season. So we'll talk a little bit about them and give our thoughts on them so far. I'd love to talk. Any chance I can talk about Summertime Rendering, I'm going to do it. So we'll see. We'll see. But anyways, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Next week's probably going to be longer. Spriggan kind of came out of nowhere, so that's just another one to throw onto the list. So, and I think there's another show coming like this week. Which one was it coming this week? Oh, Bastard. That's probably another one. We'll see. We'll see if I can get a chance to watch it. But anywho, hope you guys enjoy this episode as always, and we thank everybody for their support, both by telling other people about us, which definitely helps us out. Getting word of mouth is the best way to spread our podcast, and we definitely appreciate that. And again, additionally, supporting us on Patreon, our tips link, and our super thanks button if you're on YouTube. All the links are at talkofspirit.com. We also have a merch place, shop.talkofspirit.com. And yeah, we thank everybody for their support as always, and y'all take care.
Oh.